Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
So how's the college responding to this incident?
We're having a race forum.
And what's that?
A forum on race, so we can discuss the incident and the surrounding issues of race.
So the usual lip service.
No comment.
In the aftermath of police killings of black men and women, and amidst renewed calls in Congress to consider a reparations commission, American institutions of all kinds have looked to their pasts and presents to understand their relationships to racism. That reckoning continues at colleges and universities, many of which have direct connections to the history of slavery. Jeffrey Brown has our report. It's part of our Race Matters series and our arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
On the campus of the University of Virginia, a new memorial to the thousands of enslaved people who helped build the school and then worked there. Craftsmen, construction workers, cooks, domestic servants. Some of their names are known. Most, more than 3,000, remain anonymous, honored by so-called memory marks in the stone.
And this site was picked intentionally because it was visible to and gestures to the community.
Historian Kurt Vondack helped lead the effort to uncover his school's past.
This story has to be visible on our landscape in a way that the casual visitor will understand when they visit here. And we have to acknowledge, right, the humanity, the skill, the life, the labor of the enslaved, and do it in a way that responds to current community concerns. And I think our memorial really does a fantastic job of that. But it's not an end, it's a beginning.
It's a story often hidden in plain sight, as in this 19th century engraving, intended to capture the campus in all its glory. There on a balcony, an enslaved woman holding the child of a professor. The campus was designed and founded in 1819 by Thomas Jefferson, drafter of the Declaration of Independence and slave owner, the embodiment of the contradictions of U.S. history.
The American Academy, writ large, not just UVA, has been built on money from the slave trade, built by enslaved people. It has a very long financial and human history tied up in this story that universities in some way are now coming to terms with.
It's not just in the South. Higher education's look within began early in the 2000s at several schools, including Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
What can we do to suggest ways of being in the world that improve upon everybody's life?
Then President Ruth Simmons, the first African American to serve as president of an Ivy League school, and herself the great granddaughter of slaves, says when she looked for the history, she found little.
And so, what's the reason for that? I think slavery was an uncomfortable topic for people for so long in this country. And rather than deal with the issues involving slavery, people simply deleted the reference. And if you delete it long enough, of course, what happens is that there is this systematic forgetting of the history.
As documented in a landmark 2006 report, the history was all around, including lists of slaves trafficked in ships owned by John Brown, one of the school's founders. His former home across the street from the president's residence.
That's the thing, is that we were surrounded by the evidence of Brown's relationship to slavery at one time, and yet we chose to ignore it, and we basically built a new narrative around it.
With a more painful past revealed, Brown took a number of steps, including creating a new Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice, to further explore the history through scholarship and exhibitions. And it commissioned a public artwork titled Slave Memorial by prominent black artist Martin Puryear.
to me, it always seemed the most important element of it was the truth telling. So if one wants to atone for lying for so many decades, centuries even, the clear indication is that you should atone for that by telling the truth. And so the report to me was the most important thing. And it has lived long, actually. And I think it has been borne out by what followed, because that report has become the document that so many other institutions have used to follow that same course.
A consortium founded at the University of Virginia, University Studying Slavery, has grown to more than 70 members from 5 countries, in some cases moving beyond slavery times to study Jim Crow-era racism and injustices against Native Americans, their lands taken for use by Western colleges. Importantly, historically black colleges and universities are also looking at their histories, and in some cases partnering with majority white schools on research and other projects. Ruth Simmons is now president of one prominent HBCU, Prairie View A&M University in Texas.
One of the things that we are committed to doing is making sure that these matters enter curricula and that people stop being afraid of the truth, afraid to teach what really transpired.
But after a year of protests in the wake of the police killings of George Floyd and other black men and women, universities, like other institutions, face renewed calls to go beyond research and teaching.
This is the recurring question, what now? I think the what now is, there's no simple solution, but it's an awareness and a consciousness and a working through of the problem.
Leslie Harris, an historian now at Northwestern University, has studied both the past and contemporary efforts. The movement for direct monetary reparations has grown, but remains controversial. Harris and others propose another way in.
I want to remind people that the root of that word is repair. How do we repair? How do we make whole relationships and communities that have been driven apart? And that can come in many different ways.
Colleges are often the largest landowners and employers in their cities, with direct influence on housing costs and jobs. They employ their own police and security forces, in some cases exacerbating tensions with the surrounding community.
I could do the history all day of how we got here in terms of policing, how we got here in terms of real estate. The question, though, then becomes, and this is definitely a question for higher education institutions, it is not simply about studying and understanding and then putting the book on the shelf and say, phew, now I understand. It is about how do we move forward differently.
Study and remember what happened and seek repair. At a pivot point for American institutions of all kinds, scholars and activists are saying universities have a unique role to play. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Continue to ask the questions, continue to seek the answers.
The Half Has Never Been Told: Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism by Edward E. Baptist.
School kids have read a few famous accounts of slavery for generations, stories of people like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs. These are often tales of resistance, rebellion, and daring escapes. Well, the writer Clint Smith has been thinking about the many stories we don't tell that have been lost or buried. His new piece for The Atlantic is titled, We Mourn for All We Do Not Know. Clint Smith, welcome to All Things Considered.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Begin by telling us just some of the reasons that there are so few accounts from enslaved and recently freed people.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that the vast majority of enslaved people were illiterate. They couldn't read, they couldn't write, and it's not because they were, you know, obviously not inherently incapable of doing so. The reason is because they were specifically and legally prevented from doing so. There were specific punishments in place, often lethal consequences, if someone attempted to learn to read and write. And so as a result, the only way that people could tell their stories was if they somehow subverted the system and learned to read and write, or in a context in which they may have escaped and often partnered with abolitionists. But we don't have the stories and words from the vast majority of enslaved people simply because they weren't allowed to to share them.
There is a trove of stories that come from a program called the Federal Writers Project. Tell us about what that project set out to do.
Yeah, so the Federal Writers Project is really this remarkable treasure trove of information. It was a project done between 1936 and 1938 as part of the New Deal. The U.S. government realized that there were many different groups of Americans who had lived through these profoundly important and consequential moments in American history. And part of what they wanted to do was ensure that they got firsthand accounts of these stories before these people passed away. And one of those groups, one of the biggest groups in this context, were formerly enslaved people. So they had about 2,300 formerly enslaved people who ended up being interviewed for this project over the course of 2 or 3 years and over the course of 16 to 17 states. And so we have over 2,000 first-person accounts of people who had been children right before abolition took place. And it's just this really important set of stories that don't often get the attention that they deserve.
So you've spent months going through these accounts. You've read these stories. And what have you learned? How has it changed your own perception of history?
Part of what I think is so important is to lift up and hear the voices of those who are ostensibly ordinary people. And by saying they're ordinary, I don't mean that they are not remarkable and exceptional in their own right. But I think to have accounts of the sort of daily, quotidian, brutal nature of enslavement from people who did not escape, from people who did not learn to read and write, from people who, you know, they were born onto a plantation that their parents had been born onto and that their children would be born onto and that their children would be born onto, that reflects the intergenerational violence that slavery was, is so important, but also important because what we see in these narratives is not simply the brutality. We certainly see that. We see the violence, we see the brutality, we see the cruelty. But we also see these glimpses and these small moments in which enslaved people are saying that, like, I am still human. I am still someone who falls in love. I am still someone who raises my children to be kind and to be generous. I am still someone who loves to dance with my friends on a Saturday night while the moon is shining down. And there's these, the narratives are full of those moments that remind you of the personhood of these people who, in so much of our teaching of history, are sort of these silhouettes or these abstractions, these people without names and faces. And part of what these narratives offer us is the opportunity to see them for who they were.
And also they remind us that no one description of what life was like under slavery in the years that followed will ever fully represent the totality of the experience.
Absolutely. You know, slavery was a cruel experience, but it also looked different in so many different contexts. One of the historians I spoke to said that, you know, sometimes people don't want to use the Federal Writers Project narratives because of the biases that they feel might exist, you know, whether from the interviewer or from the interviewee. But she also said that, you know, in the letters that we use from our founding fathers, in the letters that we use from plantation owners, in the letters that we use from the people who have been the primary source of our primary source documents for centuries, those are filled with bias as well.
Right. Thomas Jefferson was biased.
Thomas Jefferson was biased. He both drafted the Declaration of Independence and he wrote of black people that they were inferior to white people in both endowments of body and mind. And you have to take both of those things into account and account for them as you sort of bring as many historical documents and primary sources together to make sense of what this period of time meant.
You write about some people living today who learned more about their ancestral history through these narratives. Will you tell us about one of them?
Yeah, one of the parts I enjoyed most about this project was getting to have conversations with people who were the descendants of those who were interviewed for this project. And one of those people whose story I was most moved by was Noah Lewis. And his great-great-grandfather was a man named William Sykes who was interviewed as part of the Federal Writers Project. And for Noah, it was this life-changing, trajectory-shifting moment in which, you know, he had always been interested in family history and genealogy. But then after he discovered William Sykes' narrative, just felt so profoundly moved that he wanted to spend the rest of his life working to bring history, and specifically the history of black people, to as many people as possible. And sort of now he's deeply involved in the reenactment community. He does reenactments of black soldiers from the Revolutionary War, because for him it's really important to make sure that people don't only understand the black experience in this country as one of being on the receiving end of violence, of one as being on the receiving end of cruelty, but as a group of people who in spite of that cruelty, in spite of that violence, have contributed so much to this country, contributed through the military, contributed through culture, contributed through literature, and has now dedicated his life to embodying that story every day.
You end this article talking about the need to document the experiences of Black people living today who survived the civil rights fights of the 1960s and so on. What do you think we're losing if we don't do that?
You know, I sat down with my own grandparents a couple of years ago and started asking them questions about their life in ways that I hadn't asked them before. And they told me stories about growing up. You know, my grandfather was born in 1930, Jim Crow apartheid, Mississippi. My grandmother born in 1939, Jim Crow apartheid, Florida. And it was this really remarkable moment because I learned so much about their lives that I hadn't understood before. And I think there are just millions and millions of people across this country who have lived through Jim Crow. And I just think it's so valuable and so important to collect those stories before that group passes on. It is so important for us to document those stories and to do it at scale, because if we don't, we might fall into the trap of misunderstanding and misremembering what happened and how it happened.
Clint Smith is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and his latest piece is part of the magazine's Inheritance Project, dedicated to elevating underreported Black history. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
A lot of
people say
it's China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
Someone said that people were racist against Asians. I think that's dishonest. She could have just said racist. People that are racist. But nope, that wasn't going to happen.
But we're going to start with another important story that hasn't gotten much attention. Attacks against the Asian American and Pacific Islander population are on the rise across the U.S. In recent weeks, there's been a surge in violent incidents in the Bay Area and beyond, specifically targeting Asian American elders. In San Francisco, an 84-year-old Thai man died after being shoved to the ground during a morning walk. And in nearby Oakland, a 91-year-old man was violently pushed to the ground, unprovoked, in the city's Chinatown. But the recent violence against the AAPI population isn't coming out of nowhere. Since the pandemic started, anti-Asian racism and violence have surged in the U.S., in part fueled by the racist and xenophobic rhetoric and policies that came out of the Trump White House. According to Stop AAPI Hate, an organization tracking racist incidents against Asian Americans, there have been more than 2,800 incidents of anti-Asian discrimination since March. That includes everything from physical violence and verbal harassment to bullying and vandalism. And although it's unclear whether the recent attacks were racially motivated, the pain and fear experienced by the AAPI population is clear. This surge in anti-Asian violence is where we start on The Takeaway today. With me to talk about this is Chris Kwok, a mediator based in New York City and co-executive editor of a new report, A Rising Tide of Hate and Violence Against Asian Americans in New York During COVID-19. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And also with us is Russell Jung, a professor with the Asian American Studies Department at San Francisco State University and a co-founder of the group Stop AAPI Hate. Russell, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So, Russell, let's start with some of the recent incidents of anti-Asian violence. What's happening in the Bay Area and elsewhere in California?
Well, it's been horrific. You know, during Lunar New Year, the first thing you do is greet your seniors, your elders, and bow to them. And now, instead, what we're seeing are horrific attacks against our senior and elderly population. And there's been a spate of street violence and crime that, again, aren't necessarily racially motivated, but are just creating a fear and anxiety within the Asian American community.
And so you talk about motive. Has there been a motive identified in these attacks?
Not that we know of yet. But what we do know is that in the past year, anti-Asian racism and hate have surged, not only because of the fear of the pandemic, but because of the racist political rhetoric that just has incited hate speech and then hate violence.
And so, Russell, you talked about the Lunar New Year. So this is a chance for many Asian families to gather together. How are communities responding to these attacks right now?
I think our community has really stood up against the racism and the violence directed towards us. In the Bay Area, over 50 community groups have held rallies the past weekend for to show support of our elders and to heal our communities, to build racial solidarity. So, and across the nation, I've seen celebrities and athletes, high school students, people from all walks of life really rallying to and mobilizing to stop the racism.
And Chris, these kinds of anti-Asian attacks aren't just happening in California, but they're happening across the U.S. So you recently authored a report that was looking at this trend in New York City. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found?
What we found in 2020 was the ninefold increase in anti-Asian attacks in New York City. And these are just statistics that the NYPD has collected. So we think it's just the tip of the iceberg and that they were actually much more in 2020. And, you know, this concerned us because we are not aware of any prosecutions on the criminal side, nor any resolutions on the civil side of any of these incidents. So we're worried as to where it's leading in New York City as well.
And so can you tell us how this racism manifests itself besides the very violent assaults? What else is the AAPI population experiencing?
It ranges, and it's directed towards like mothers playing with their children at the playground, where other mothers would say, you know, hey, you know, don't play with that Asian, you know, kid, because they're the ones that brought Corona here. So it really runs the gamut, and it's a chilling sort of effect on Asian Americans as they go about their daily lives.
And Russell, is that a similar experience in California for the Asian community?
Yeah, it's clear. People are targeting what they perceive are vulnerable populations. Women are harassed 2.4 times more than men. Youth and elderly are disproportionately represented in our reports.
And what is this doing to people's mental health, Russell?
Oh, it's had a severe impact. Not only are Asian Americans concerned about getting COVID, they're concerned about their elderly parents. We live in more multi-generational households than the rest of the nation. We're concerned about our livelihood. And then the racism compounds the stress and anxiety. So Asian Americans are the racial group experiencing the most depression, anxiety, and from the racism, racial trauma during COVID-19.
And so, Russell, there has been some arrests in California, at least one arrest. Is that person being charged with a hate crime?
No, not necessarily. Hate crimes, again, are incidents where you can be arrested and where there's racial bias that's been demonstrated. And again, these incidents seemingly are unprovoked and there aren't witnesses to hear what the person said, so you can't tell if it was racially motivated or not. We do know in our incidents that have been reported, about one third include racist statements when the perpetrators say things like, go back home, you effing chink, or it's because of you and your people we have the coronavirus. So people are using racist language and racial slurs to attack us.
And Chris, how is the NYPD responding?
Well, they created an anti-Asian task force, and, you know, we applaud them for that. And, you know, our recommendation was that they go further along. They made it permanent recently, but we think that, you know, right now it's a volunteer task force, which means that the detectives are serving full time on another role and then take this on a volunteer basis. We think it should be a full-time assignment and the commander be given a budget and have this, you know, sort of exist until there's no need for it.
And Chris, do you believe that a lot of these incidents are going unreported?
Absolutely. You know, there's a big language disconnect between the police and Asian American populations, particularly ones who don't speak English well. And, you know, there is, I think, a general feeling that if you report it, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be extremely time consuming. So we have specific recommendations that we think might make it easier, you know, for these reports to be taken seriously.
And Russell, are racist crimes against the AAPI population historically underreported?
Yeah, they've been historically underreported for the same reasons Chris mentioned, language access, thinking it's not going to do any good. It's clear that we're receiving much more reports than the police are, including physical assaults. So people are reporting to us because we have 12 different languages. We're a trusted community partner. And because people feel like they don't necessarily want to criminalize people, but our people, our respondents want a collective voice just to stop it from happening to others.
And for either of you, what's the media coverage been like? Have these attacks been getting much attention from mainstream media?
I mean, I think that they have been covered, particularly in the beginning, which was like in March of 2020, and then it petered out during BLM. And then I think that social media, you know, in the recent sort of death of the Thai American, you know, social media really, I think, began to ring the bell. And then I think it's made its way into sort of mass media. So I think that, you know, that the social media and Asian Americans on Facebook and Twitter have really sort of remade it an issue during this, I think, second wave.
Right. There's been some celebrities who have stepped in and tried to highlight these incidents. Russell, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, even though, you know, these thousands of cases are really horrific and traumatizing, I've been actually heartened to see the Asian American community stand up and mobilize at this moment. So we're seeing people from all walks of life, celebrities, athletes, but also, you know, high school students, data scientists, working with Stop AAPI Hate to address this racism and to call for racial solidarity at this moment.
The list of things to do in Seattle is long.
Black and Latino Americans are getting vaccinated at far lower rates nationwide, and the state of Washington is no exception. 65% of the state's white population has been fully vaccinated. That's according to a new report from the state's health department. In contrast, less than 3% of the state's black population has gotten both doses of the vaccine. Well, now some unconventional efforts are underway to close that gap, like pop-up vaccine clinics in communities of color. Joining us now is Ahmed Ali. He's a pharmacist and the executive director of the Somali Health Board, and he's been setting up these pop-up clinics throughout Seattle. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, Ahmed, how effective have these vaccine pop-ups been so far?
I think that these vaccine pop-up sites have been very effective. As we all know that initially, with good intentions, majority of the vaccine accessibility was mainly through the internet, our folks who are able to access the internet. And fortunately, that leaves many of our community members who are facing technological gap, cultural barriers, and even sometimes linguistic barriers. And we've been able to set up multiple pop-up sites for the vaccine for Black and brown immigrant refugee communities throughout Southeast Seattle, and it's going really well so far.
You've done videos in Somali to help people overcome their fears. Let's take a listen. Ahmed, it was important to you to have messages in the native language of the communities you're trying to reach. What major questions have you been able to answer this way that members of the Somali community weren't getting?
You know, it's interesting that much like any other communities, the Somali community had multiple questions and a lot of misinformation about the COVID vaccine. And I did this video primarily to show, and along with my colleagues at Somali Health Board, and we wanted to send a message to the community that these vaccines are efficient and they're safe. So I think it did a really good work indicating that me as a healthcare provider, I've got my vaccine, I'm doing fine, there are no side effects of the need to worry about. And therefore, that made a lot of community members comfortable to come and get the vaccine when it was their time to get vaccinated.
This is a very important point to make because building that trust is so important here. You've been to Brighton House, that's an affordable housing unit with many immigrant seniors living there. I know that that was a great success. How do you actually go about choosing where to host these pop-ups?
You know, I would like to say that a lot of these pop-up sites are connected through already established relationships. We're working with these community centers and apartments at a previous time, so that we know the need within the communities that we are currently working with to make sure they get have access to the vaccines. For instance, Bria Chafosky-Louis, who is a member of the Brighton Task Force, made sure that we, once we received the vaccines at the pharmacy, that the seniors who are having difficulties getting online appointments have the first vaccine pop-up site. So we worked along with the managers of low-income senior home residents, the community centers, and also trusted ambassadors within the community in terms of leadership. And that made it easier for us to make sure that these vaccines are allocated.
Washington State has just announced a new initiative that looks to raise about $30 million to fund equity efforts in getting folks vaccinated. And as I mentioned, vaccine rollout has not been racially equitable across the country. What advice do you have to other pharmacists or medical professionals that are looking to make a difference in getting vaccines distributed fairly where they are?
I particularly want to make sure that folks understand that majority of Americans across the country are probably within walking distance of pharmacies and mainly independent pharmacies. And I think they have a huge opportunity and oftentimes play a significant role as they understand their communities well. They can relate to the families that are in need of the vaccine as accessibility becomes more evident in the near future.
I know you're actually headed to a pop-up today, so thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Ahmed Ali, pharmacist and executive director of the Somali Health Board that's setting up pop-up vaccine clinics in Seattle, Washington.
The toll of the pandemic is highlighted in stark terms again today. A government report finds that expected lifespans fell in this country by a year on average in the first half of 2020. That is the largest drop since World War II. Overdoses, heart attacks, and other illnesses are part of that. But researchers say the pandemic undoubtedly is a major factor. Moreover, the gaps along racial lines are profound. White life expectancy fell by about 8 months, while Black Americans lost 2.7 years of average life expectancy. Among Latinos, life expectancy dropped by nearly 2 years. And these numbers are even larger among men. Experts say that this points to major socioeconomic disparities, and we're going to focus on that tonight. Dr. Reed Tuckson is a former commissioner of public health here in Washington, D.C., who now has his own firm. He's one of the leaders of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Dr. Tuckson, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We appreciate it. First of all, overall, as you look at these numbers broadly, are they surprising?
They are not surprising. We have known and experienced this excess exposure of African Americans to the COVID pandemic. We knew that we were dying two times more often than the rest of the country and being hospitalized three times more. So it is not surprising. However, it still does not dim the sadness, the pain, the heartache that comes with looking at these quantitative numbers that are really describing in mathematical ways the feelings and emotions that we've had all along.
So when you see, Dr. Tuckson, as you mentioned, Black Americans, the average drop life expectancy three times, that what it is for white Americans. Among Latinos, it's two times the drop that it is for white Americans. Why is this?
Well, we know, first of all, that African Americans are exposed to this virus more often than other people because of the nature of the jobs that we have, that so many of us are the ones on the front lines in running our buses and subways, in the retail industry, the ones cleaning our streets. We are the ones who are more often unable to practice make our livelihood by being at home and working online. So we're much more exposed. Number two, the conditions under which so many African Americans live, make it very difficult to fight off this COVID pandemic. We are often and more often living in crowded housing with multi-generational families. We have much less opportunity to do the social distancing that we wanted to have done. And then third and finally, a major element is that pre-existing, we were suffering from pre-existing chronic health issues, more heart disease, more lung disease, more diabetes, more obesity. And all of those, as we have learned from the beginning of the pandemic, predispose to poorer outcomes when you are finally infected with the COVID-19 virus.
It's so interesting that a number of the things you're discussing are parallel to what we heard from Dr. Bullard a few minutes ago in discussing why communities of color are disproportionately affected by these terrible winter storms and the conditions that come from them. But Dr. Tuckson, what about just in terms of health care services and what is available and what isn't in communities of color?
Well, first of all, I think it is very important to go back to the point that you're making about Dr. Ballard and the comments that he made. Remember that health is the place where all of the social forces converge to express themselves with the greatest clarity and the most importance. Health is where everything comes together. So when we think about the health outcomes of people of color, it's not just medical care. It is very much the social determinants that lead to health outcomes: housing, economic instability, education, challenging access to healthy foods, community environments that are filled with stress and are not safe. And then we come to the quality of care. And that point is very important. We have known now for 20 years since the publication of a major National Academy of Medicine study called Unequal Treatment that the delivery of health care to people of color is suboptimal compared to white America, for a variety of reasons. And so this is a long-standing challenge that unfortunately the healthcare industry has yet to be able to fully and adequately address.
And I think part of what is so striking, and I was looking at the numbers this afternoon, is that among Black Americans, life expectancy had actually been improving. It had been increasing in the last couple of decades. So this is a really stark turn in the direction of where we want to see these numbers go. Does it tell you, I mean, we all know the country was caught off guard, was not prepared for this pandemic. Do you believe there are going to be clear lessons we can learn, we can do something with coming out of this pandemic?
I hope so. And I hope the first lesson that we learn, and this pandemic has shown such a bright light, is that each of us as individuals live in the context of a community of other people. So that when we choose as individuals to exert a right not to wear a mask and don't care that we could easily sicken or cause someone else to die, that is a major issue now of an ethical and moral nature in front of the society. If we have learned anything, it is that we have to begin to focus our attention on empathy and love, a concern and caring for everyone. For Black people, this is particularly important because we now realize that Black people have, because of a history of deeply planted seeds of distrust, and those seeds being watered every day by our experience in living our lives in American society, that distrust leads to very negative behaviors. It leads us to make decisions sometimes that are contrary to our best interests. And so now we know that as we go forward, that we've learned the lesson that we have to bond together. And certainly the health enterprise, the researchers, the clinicians, and the health policy experts have got to come together now and try to do everything we can with the rest of our society to overcome this distrust, because this distrust is not just an idle emotion. Distrust leads to death. And then finally, I think what this does is to focus everyone's attention on getting at these structural racism issues, these social determinants of health that were always present in creating excess experiences with disease and death. But now we know what it does for a pandemic like COVID-19. And hopefully it will now regenerate a much greater focus on getting at these root and fundamental causes.
Well, it is certainly something that we at the NewsHour are committed to continue to cover. And again, so stark, seeing these numbers over just the first half of 2020, seeing the life expectancy change, incredibly discouraging. Dr. Reed Tuckson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
A lingering mistrust of the medical system makes some Black Americans more hesitant to sign up for COVID-19 vaccines. The early data show a stark disparity in who is getting shots in this country. More than 60% going to white people and less than 6% to African Americans. The mistrust is rooted in history, including the infamous U.S. study of syphilis that left Black men in Tuskegee, Alabama, to suffer from the disease. NPR's Debbie Elliott traveled to Tuskegee to see how that 20th century tragedy affects the vaccine rollout today.
Cheryl Owens says she grew alarmed talking with family and friends and elderly relatives in Tuskegee who told her they were afraid to get a COVID vaccine.
So I asked why. And it was like, well, you remember that Tuskegee syphilis study? That's why.
Officially named the Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male, the U.S. Public Health Service, working with the Tuskegee Institute, recruited hundreds of rural Black men in 1932, offering free meals and checkups, but never explaining that they'd be human subjects in a study designed to deny them medical treatment.
They had local leaders, church leaders, medical people, to convince them to become involved with the study.
Owens is a nurse at the Central Alabama Veterans Healthcare System and grew up in Tuskegee, a city of about 8,000. It has a storied African-American history as home to the Tuskegee Airmen, and Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver were educators here. But the syphilis study also looms large in Tuskegee's collective memory. Owens, who is 59, says she remembers hearing about it in elementary school, so she understands why people in this nearly all-Black community are skeptical when the government says take a shot.
And they felt that the government was really wanted to inject something in their bodies, and they were going to eventually die from that.
To help dispel that notion, Owens penned an op-ed in the local newspaper, including a picture of her getting the shot. Health officials are up against a powerful sentiment as they try to ramp up vaccinations.
I think a part of the challenge is that there's still a lot of anxiety about the vaccine.
Amir Farouki is director of the Central Alabama VA.
It's unfortunate because it's a really great tool to help people protect their personal health as well as the public health.
Thank you for choosing to protect yourself from the coronavirus by being vaccinated today.
In a large auditorium at the VA's Tuskegee campus, an informational video explaining just what to expect plays on an overhead screen as people wait their turn for a shot.
Such as muscle fatigue, joint pain, swollen glands.
78-year-old Vietnam veteran Douglas Terry is masked up and ready to get one.
With this, there's hope.
Nurse Pamela Bell gives him his first jab.
You through?
Yes, sir. Can't feel it?
Not at all.
Good.
Terry says he intends to spread the word that he and his wife got the injection.
After they hear us doing it, that's why we want to do it. So to get them encouraged to do it also.
That's what VA officials want to hear. They've set up a selfie station at the clinic and hand out stickers proclaiming you've been vaccinated. The VA's infectious disease physician, Dr. April Truitt, says that word of mouth will be key to overcoming reservations about the shot.
The more people hear about the vaccine, the more they know someone else who's received the vaccine, the more they see how well they did, the more comfortable they become with the vaccine.
It's the biggest PR project to get Black people to take that vaccine.
Lucenia Williams Dunn is the former mayor of Tuskegee and runs a local community development organization. She's not convinced. Even though she's been watching the pandemic's devastating and disproportionate impact on African Americans, she still questions the rapid development of the vaccine. And then there's the history.
You cannot separate the experience of the past with what we believe in the present. I mean, people say, well, you know, y'all ought not to be worried about that syphilis study. Yeah, we do, because that's part of our experience.
The vaccine rollout has sparked a conversation among descendants of the men involved in the syphilis study. Among them is Thylene Williams of Tuskegee. She says her grandfather died before knowing the truth about the study.
Grandfather, his name was Willie Fitzpatrick. He was a good man, family man. a farmer.
She says there's a difference between what's happening now and what the government did to her grandfather and the other men.
They didn't know what they were getting into.
Williams, who is 72, says she was able to talk with her doctor about the vaccine.
I went on and got it, the first shot. Because we knew about it. We've been hearing and talking about it. It's not like, come on, we're going to do this. Nobody knew anything about it like they did.
Her grandfather is among those now memorialized at the Tuskegee History Center on a large tile circle in the middle of the museum.
And around here in alphabetical order, you have the names of all 623 men.
That's Tuskegee civil rights attorney Fred Gray, who represented the men when the truth came out about the study in the 1970s, 40 years after it began. Participants were not injected with syphilis, but those who already had it were left untreated, even once penicillin was available.
Not only did they withhold treatment from it, but they sent these men's names to the various doctors in the area and told them if they came to their office not to treat them for syphilis.
Gray won a $10 million settlement for the men and later secured this apology from President Clinton in 1997.
What the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
Gray, who is 90 years old now, takes issue with people citing the syphilis study as a reason not to get vaccinated.
Individuals, if they elect not to take the vaccine, for whatever reason, but they shouldn't put it, is because of what the government did to the men in the Tuskegee syphilis study, because they're altogether different situations.
A January poll from Kaiser Family Foundation found that more than half of black adults surveyed said they did not have immediate plans to get vaccinated. 43% said they were going to wait and see how well it's working. That hesitancy is to be expected, says Reuben Warren, director of the National Center for Bioethics and Research and Healthcare at Tuskegee University, established and funded by the federal government as a result of the syphilis study. He says the mistrust of the healthcare system among African Americans is twofold.
It's both historical and current, and not either or, but both and.
Dating to slavery and continuing through the eugenics movement, he says, black bodies have been medically abused. Now, he says, the coronavirus pandemic and its disparate impact on people of color have exposed the shortcomings of the U.S. healthcare delivery system. For instance, there's no hospital serving the general public in Tuskegee, and COVID testing was hard to come by here early on.
So it's not just historical, but it's current. So the combination of that makes folks pause.
Warren says seeing the mayor and community leaders getting vaccinated is not the kind of assurance that people need. What they need to know, he says, is that the healthcare system will deliver for them in the future. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Tuskegee, Alabama.
You dirt. We think you're dirt, Paul.
Who is we?
The West. All the superpowers. Everything you believe in, Paul. They think you're dirt. They think you're dumb. You're worthless.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you are saying, sir.
Oh, come on, don't bullshit me, Paul. You're the smartest man here. You got them all eating out of your hands. You could own this freaking hotel, except for one thing. You're black. You're not even a nigger. You're an African.
Millions of Americans have already received their coronavirus vaccines, but poor countries in sub-Saharan Africa have managed to administer only a handful. The disparity is bringing back memories of the AIDS epidemic, when hundreds of thousands of Africans died because life-saving drugs were delayed. NPR's Eder Peralta reports.
In 2001, Maureen Murenga was pregnant and HIV positive. She was living in Kenya, and a counselor encouraged her to fill out a memory book. She wrote directions to her village, details about her family, so that when she died, someone would know where to leave her children and where to bury her.
It was nothing life-preparing. It was actually preparing us for death.
What seemed so unfair to Murenga is that she knew that in the United States and in Europe, there were drugs that could save her life. Antiretroviral drugs, or ARVs, had been widely available in the West since 1997, but they were too expensive for most Africans on the continent. Murenga became a vocal advocate, publicly disclosing her status, lobbying the Kenyan government and the world to make the life-saving drugs more accessible.
It took a lot of pushing and pulling and wishing we could inject them with compassion to save lives.
Over the next few years, countries like South Africa took principled stands, fighting against patents to make the drugs more affordable. AIDS activists across the world banded together to lobby rich countries to end what scientists called a crime against humanity.
At least the world listened.
In the early 2000s, the U.S. launched PEPFAR, and an international coalition launched the Global Fund. The programs pumped billions of dollars into buying ARVs and saved millions of lives around the world. Murenga says as the coronavirus spread, she thought the West would have learned from the HIV experience, but...
As usual, we are waiting for them to finish vaccinating their people so that they can now bring aid to the people of Africa.
I think we are repeating some of the mistakes, and that is truly unacceptable.
That is Alan Maleche, who advocates for the legal rights of Kenyans with HIV. He says right now rich countries are hoarding vaccines, poor countries are paying higher prices for them, and the central lesson of the HIV epidemic, that if one person is vulnerable, everyone is vulnerable, seems lost.
If you don't address both the rich and the poor countries, you will not be able to win the fight, be it for HIV, be it for TB, or be it for COVID.
Stephen Thrasher, whose upcoming book deals with how marginalized people are disproportionately affected by viruses, calls the development of antiretroviral drugs, quote, one of the great miracles of modern science. It made HIV easier to treat than diabetes. He views the global response, PEPFAR and the Global Fund, more critically. Millions of lives were saved, but people are still dying.
Is that the science won the battle, but capitalism made the war be lost, because it's been 25 years and almost 1 million people a year still die of HIV.
He says the same thing is happening with the COVID vaccine. Cheaper generic vaccines are not available, and Africa is being left behind. And unlike the days of the HIV epidemic, there doesn't seem to be popular pressure to end this disparity. He recalls Zaki Ahmed in South Africa. He was a film director who refused to take ARVs until poorer people could access them. Thrasher, who is American, says that kind of empathy is in short supply these days.
We're certainly not saying as a country, we're not going to take it until we make sure the poor countries get it. We've been set into a scramble of everyone trying to get it as quickly as they can.
As for Maureen Murenga, she eventually got the ARVs, but her fight is not over.
As an advocate, it's about lives.
Yeah.
So we don't rest until we see these lives have been saved.
It's what she did during the AIDS epidemic. It is what she'll do now. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Nairobi.
The stars at night are big and bright.
Where does that happen, Ray?
Deep in the heart of Texas.
In Texas today, the electrical grid is still groaning under the weight of treacherous winter weather. Millions of people in Texas spent last night in the dark and in the cold. Doctors are worried that more could suffer from hypothermia if the power outages continue. And now it's not just Texas. More than a dozen other states are bracing for rolling blackouts to help preserve the weakened grid. Joining us now is Lanny Nickel. He's executive vice president for Southwest Power Pool, which manages much of the grid in the central part of the country. And Lanny, I have heard you say that in your history as grid operator, you have never seen anything like this. Tell me about the rolling blackouts you've ordered beyond Texas and your messages to utilities in those states.
You bet. And the term blackouts has a really negative connotation, and I certainly do not want to trivialize the situation we're in. We prefer to call those interrupted service conditions. And
wow, hey, yo, drama, hold up, stop the motherfucking record.
All right. Black, destitute of light, devoid of color, enveloped in darkness, hence utterly dismal or gloomy, as the future looked black.
Pretty good with them words, ain't you?
Soiled with dirt, foul, sullen, hostile, forbidding, as a black day. Foully or outrageously wicked, as black cruelty, indicating disgrace, dishonor, or culpability. And there's others. Black male, black bald, black guard.
Yeah, well, there's something all right.
The term blackouts has a really negative connotation, and I certainly do not want to trivialize the situation we're in. We prefer to call those interrupted service conditions, and when we get to the point, which is exactly where we've been, at least for certain periods of time throughout Monday and Tuesday of this week, where the resources, the supply that we have available after we've done everything we can do to turn those generators on and to use them to the fullest extent that we can, if demand exceeds that supply, we have no choice but to interrupt back to the point to where demand equals supply.
Well, no matter whether you call them blackouts or service disruptions, I mean, there are millions of people around the country who are depending on this system to work. I mean, in Nebraska, people woke up today and it was 31 degrees below zero. This is life or death. What can you tell those people about when this situation will be back to normal, to the way it should be?
So far today, things are looking better. We could certainly be right back into the situation because there's so many factors that play into these decisions that impact us that are really in some cases outside our control. What we are trying to do is to proactively manage the situation so that we don't lose control of the grid. If we lose control of the grid, then the outages that would occur as a result of the system taking over and doing its own thing to protect itself could be much longer, could be much severe, and could impact many, many more people. And that is the last thing we want to see happen. While it's not fun, it's not comfortable, at least it's better than experiencing the results of what could happen in an uncontrolled fashion.
Oh, well, I do appreciate the fact that the job is daunting, though there are many people in Texas and across the middle of the country who probably feel that there are things that are within your control that maybe could have been done before this storm hit the country. For instance, one of the major problems we know is that the supply of natural gas has faced tremendous pressure as the wells and pipelines in that region have frozen up. I mean, is there something that grid operators could have done better because they relied too much on a single source of energy, for instance?
You know, at this point in time, I can't tell you what we could have done differently because, you know, whether that's gas, whether that's wind, whether it's solar, whether it's coal, we have absolutely no input regarding the decisions about the nature of the generating plants that do get built. We just simply have to use what's made available to us, and we do direct that any and all resources that can operate, that they do operate. You know, the interruptions of service is a last resort, and we will continue to make sure that we do everything we can before we interrupt load.
Several times I've heard you hint at some dark alternatives that could be happening here if the problem isn't handled correctly. What do you mean? What are you saying? How bad could this get?
All I can do is refer you to situations in the past where events weren't controlled. I recall the blackout in the northeastern part of the United States that occurred in 2003. Now that was a different situation. It had nothing to do with cold weather, but it wasn't controlled, and the system began to separate because the individual elements of the system are designed to protect themselves whenever overloaded equipment begins to occur. And so, I mean, that affected millions of people, and they were without power for days, and, you know, the cost was really extreme, and that's what we don't want to have happen. I can tell you that if we didn't curtail the 641 megawatts or 1.5% of our customer base Monday and 6.5% on Tuesday, we would have seen frequency excursions that would have caused generators to begin to trip offline. And I can't tell you when it would have stopped.
Lanny Nickel, Executive Vice President for Southwest Power Pool, which operates the power grid for 14 states in the middle of the country. Lanny, you've got a lot on your hands, so thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
You bet. Thank you very much, Peter.
You think she realized by now it's the hair? It's all about the hair.
Hair? What hair? She ain't got no hair.
If your hair has been falling out in this pandemic, you're not alone. Far from it. A recent study in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology reports that New York City practitioners saw a, quote, abrupt uptick in cases of hair shedding. Some St. Louisans have noticed that trend on their own heads. That includes city resident Erin Leiden-Lorson. She left us this voicemail with her observations.
In October, I woke up with quarter-size spots that were just completely gone. I went to my doctor. I was really nervous, and I had no idea that that could happen to me. So reading your article and hearing about how normal that is and how the stress of the pandemic could influence it, that was just, again, it normalized the situation for me. Thank you. How do I stop them from multiplying? I went from 1 to 4. And they're easy to hide, but, you know, I don't know what to do.
And that is Erin Leiden-Lorson. And the problem that she describes there is particularly acute for some women of color. The journal article found a 400% increase in such cases last summer. And that's something that Abra McField is working to address here in St. Louis. She is the CEO and founder of Abracadabra Hair and Healing. She's a hair loss practitioner and a certified trichologist. And she joins us today to discuss this problem and also some solutions. So, Abra McField, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So first, give us some context on this. What does a trichologist do?
Trichology is the study of hair and scalp diseases and problems and issues that promote or cause hair loss.
So you're looking at this, the big picture issue here, not just the stress stuff, but anything that goes into this problem.
Correct.
So have you seen a big increase in clients experiencing hair loss during this pandemic?
I have, it's been astronomical, actually. Yes, definitely. Definitely has gone up quite a bit since the pandemic.
And have you noticed any commonalities in the people that are coming to you with this problem?
Yes. So stress has been a major cause. Now, obviously, there are always going to be, especially in women, more reasons than one why we would experience hair loss. But stress seems to exacerbate the issue. And if we're already vulnerable, stress definitely pushes us over that edge.
Well, we want to hear from you. If you're experiencing this problem, our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at STL on air. And we did get another voicemail about this as well. This one is from Marguerite, and she lives in St. Louis.
I can't believe it, especially when I vacuum. I have to empty the canister, and there's enough hair to make a raccoon coat. It's amazing. I don't know if it's because I switched colors. I pull hair out of my combs, my brushes, especially after shampooing. The drain has to be cleared with all the hair. I don't know what's causing it, and I'm not under immense stress. So I've decided no more coloring. I'm going to go silver.
That is Marguerite, who lives in St. Louis. Abra, she thinks that maybe the hair color that she's using is part of the problem. Can hair color contribute to this problem?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of internal and external reasons why we would experience hair loss. It kind of depends on the color that she's using. Color has ammonia, color has sulfates. Color has a bunch of ingredients that are pretty harsh for the scalp. And what it does is causes irritation, which makes the follicle that is holding the hair extremely vulnerable and less strong enough to kind of hold the hair. And so that's kind of like what happens like internally, but or externally, but internally you can also be experiencing something called DHT is short for dehydrotestosterone, which is our own body's sensitivity to testosterone, the hormone called testosterone. So it will block your hair follicles from receiving the necessary blood, nutrients, and oxygen that is needed to promote hair growth. And so if you're not getting that proper flow, if you have any type of blockages, then the activity, cellular activity shuts down, which causes a lot more shedding. So a lot of times that comes with age, a lot of times it's genetics, but there are things that you can do to reverse that issue as well. So, but yes, colors, shampoos, different type of shampoos and topicals that people can use definitely can cause irritation on the scalp, cause itchiness, inflammation, and it makes that follicle extremely vulnerable. And so by that, it can't hold the hair. It's not strong enough to hold the hair. And so the hair can either break off at the point of sight or it can shed.
It's interesting. You mentioned the idea that some of this is genetic. Are there some of us where we might be fine, but we have this genetic issue that once we get super stressed out, it's going to manifest itself?
Correct. Exactly. So if you're already predisposed to DHT, which again is short for dehydrotestosterone, our own body sensitivity to the hormone testosterone, and you're having blockages. And then when you add stress to it, what happens is you have different hair growth phases. You have phases where you have an active phase, and then you have a resting phase, and then you have a phase in which your hair sheds. What happens is when you add stress onto already vulnerable situations, about 10 to 15% of your head is always in a shedding phase. Now, it may not all shed at one time. It'll shed over time, but 10 to 15% of your head is definitely ready to shed. And what happens is when you add the stress onto it, it pushes that faster and makes it happen all at once. And so the first call with the young lady experiencing like different areas of shedding or hair loss over all of her head, that could have very well been that 10 to 15% that she was going to lose it anyway at some point. But because of stress, more than likely, it pushed it all at one point of time. It pushed it all at one time. And so usually that's called telogen effluvium. So that's called telogen effluvium when you kind of lose your telogen phase is the phase where you lose your hair, the natural shedding. But effluvium is when you lose all of it at one time.
You know, this stress that comes in this pandemic, this is no lie. We actually got a caller just now, Barbara and Clayton, who wanted to share. She was at the dentist recently. She notes that it's not just hair. More people are having cracked teeth from grinding their teeth due to stress. It's horrible how this can impact our bodies. And Amber, I did want to ask you one part of this. We mentioned this journal article that found a 400% increase for women of color when it comes to these cases. Why do you think this has affected women of color in particular?
Well, a lot of times it's really proven that women of color are less healthy overall, like really deficient and lacking a lot of nutrients and have poor diets. Everybody, you know, all of us have, you know, some type of weakness in our diet, but we're proven to be the most, you know, obese or, you know, having the most heart issues and things like that, diabetes and things like that. So you already have that working against you. And so now you put us in a situation where normally minority women put their hair in the hands of a professional completely, you know, because our hair is more natural, it's more dry, it's coily, it's kinky, it's very, very hard to manage. And a lot of us have just gotten away from the chemicals, the permanent straighteners and relaxers. And so we don't know really what to do with our hair. So we trust the professional fully to manage it for us and to help us keep it straightened and, and we go to the salon to get things done to keep it healthy. But when they shut us down during the pandemic, they no longer had that option. And so they were forced to have to figure things out on their own. And so a lot of people neglect their hair or a lot of people do too much to their hair. And so because it's kinky and coily, it causes just a lot of friction and tension. And you're constantly combing and running against resistance and brushing and running against resistance. And so you already have the natural shedding, but then you have the external shedding that is caused by the things that we are doing externally. So the stress of not having that
easy management when it comes to our hair. You know, we have to manage all of our hair on top of being a mother and working and things like that. But again, we don't know what to do. And so oftentimes we're doing the wrong things and we just do so much. Colors and relaxers and all different type of products that really cause irritation and affect our scalp. And so again, you know, to my point earlier, it's not just one issue all of the time. It's usually, especially in women, more men can point to one issue, possibly maybe two, but women especially, it can be so many issues at one time. And so again, to our point when we're talking about stress, if you already are extremely vulnerable, it's like you add stress, it's like you lose the war, you know?
Yeah. So, well, and then I'm sure it feeds on itself because then you get stressed out about what's happening with your hair.
Exactly.
And so I guess that's, you know, Abra, we need you to share some solutions here because this is stressing people out, the stress of this problem. What are some things people can do to save their hair if they start noticing this kind of shedding?
Yes. Okay. So the first thing you can do is you want to use a product that has DHT inhibitors in there, and specifically organic DHT inhibitors. I actually have a product line myself, and I made sure that the DHT inhibitors that we included in our product were organic, and that's very important. And organic usually means it's from some type of plant extract, and some products, and the crazy thing is there's not a lot of products on the market that has DHT inhibitors, but the ones that do may have one or two, and it's just simply not enough. So our products have between 8 and 11. So you want to use a product that has some type of DHT inhibitor in there because it really does help to open up the follicle so that you can receive all of the blood flow and oxygen and nutrients for just optimum hair growth. So another thing is you just don't want to always look to one solution. You want to have a multi-therapeutic approach, something that's helping internally and externally. So I would definitely, if you haven't done yet, get some blood work done to see where you are with the nutrients and vitamins that are needed, just for daily health overall. And some things like minerals, zinc is very important, biotin, all of your vitamin D's, vitamin B's, making sure that you're just not deficient in anything could really help you build up that defense for stress. And then also just with natural holistic ways, you know, just trying to figure out where the stress is coming from. I'm really big with trying to find the trigger instead of just bypassing the trigger and trying to fix the result of the trigger. Because if you still have the trigger, then, you know, you still have a very low defense. So just figuring out what is it that's actually causing stress and try to resolve that. You know, try to put yourself around people that make you laugh, that truly love and support you. Try to engage in things that are very calming to the body. It's proven that meditation and breath work really helps to calm the heart, calm the blood, hence calm the mind, which really reduces stress. And then definitely exercises and getting involved in some activities, even some creative activities that help bring a lot of joy to your life. And reading, if you have any problems anywhere, challenges, just trying to find a book to help, you know, resolve or to help combat the challenges, issues that you are having for sure. And the last thing I could think of is really just journaling. Journaling and finding things that you're grateful for instead of things that you don't have. Like wherever your mind goes, where your life goes. Is wherever your energy flows is where your life goes. So try not to focus on the things that you don't have or that you believe that you're lacking in, and try to focus on the things that you do have and finding every little reason, small or little, just to be grateful. And believe me, that really does help build up a major defense against the war of hair loss.
Well, Abra, that is just a great set of suggestions there. It kind of runs the gamut between the super practical and then the bigger picture. This is some good advice for anybody dealing with such a troubling problem. So, Abra McField, CEO and founder of Abracadabra Hair and Healing, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Give me some bologna, salami, and ham, toast with butter and strawberry jam. the food. It's cold or hot. Put a burger on the plate and it'll end spot. We'll eat everything at an incredible fee. $3.99 for all you can eat.
And if you're listening to this show while working from home, scrunched over your computer, or you just haven't been outside much because of pandemic restrictions, you might be feeling a little stiff. After a year locked down in our homes, many people are reporting an increase in aches, pains, headaches, and a whole host of other physical ailments from the stress of living through a pandemic.
This is Nancy from Silverdale, Pennsylvania. My fibromyalgia has increased and flared up. Since the pandemic, I've had to increase my medication with CBD.
Aloha. This is Michelle Grothstein calling from Kaneohe, Hawaii. I'm recovering from a pinched nerve in my neck. I think I was holding all my tension in my shoulders and neck for too long and watching too much of the impeachment trial.
Amanda Mull is a staff writer for The Atlantic who recently wrote a piece called Yes, the Pandemic is Ruining Your Body. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the pandemic is ruining my body, lots of people's bodies. I've gotten carpal tunnel syndrome recently. I've got all types of aches and pains. How common are these types of injuries right now?
They seem really common. I talked to a number of different types of doctors who have been seeing patients during the pandemic, and all of them reported different kinds of increases in injuries or problems or complaints that that they hadn't really been seeing at any particularly high volume before all of this happened. So it's affected how pretty much all doctors do their work and what they see in their practices. And it's affected pretty much every part of the human body.
Are there specific things that are coming up more often than others? Is it stiffness? Is it joint pain? Is it just, you know, headaches? Like, what is it that people are reporting? Or are people just reporting a myriad of different things?
It's a myriad of different things, but I think that the most common stuff is probably not surprising to most people. I talked to some orthopedists who said that their practice used to be mostly lower back stuff, the types of things that people commonly complain about with their backs. But now a lot of those complaints have sort of migrated up the back. You get shoulder problems, upper back, neck. You get people with headaches, things like that, because of their posture. And they said that they think that that's because people are just sitting differently. A lot of people don't have good office setups. They don't have an office chair. They might be working from their couch or from a kitchen chair, something like that. And you end up sort of curving over, jutting your chin out, hunching your shoulders. And if you hold that position for a really long time, as a lot of us have been doing day in and day out for the past year, you create a variety of aches and pains for yourself, up to things like headaches that might not have as obvious of a source, but it's all in your posture.
Now, we're talking in that instance, a lot of folks like me and others who are working from home, who are sort of sitting in, you know, we've cobbled together, hacked together these working from home environments. But there are folks that are also working on the front line still, essential workers. Are they also reporting an increase in physical aches and pains?
I would say probably. But none of the doctors that I talked to could tell me specifically what they've been seeing from frontline workers. And I think that that's a function of a lot of frontline jobs don't have healthcare, don't have paid time off. So if you're working in the service industry, if you're a delivery guy, if you're a checkout person at a grocery store, if you're, you know, moving things around a warehouse, a lot of those positions just aren't going to have the same access to healthcare that work from home jobs that are usually office jobs, computer-based jobs, knowledge jobs, white-collar jobs. Those kinds of positions are more likely to have healthcare and time off to seek care. So we are, I think, just starting to peel back the layers of all the ways that this pandemic has hurt our health. And what we're seeing now is mostly evidence from people who work from home. And I think it's going to take a little bit longer for us to find out how this has affected essential workers.
Amanda, what about the elderly? We know that they are among some of the first to be vaccinated. Some of them have already received their second dose. As they begin to become more active, are there specific issues that have cropped up for our older population during the pandemic?
Yes. I think that a big one is that for the elderly, maintaining a level of physical activity and flexibility and dexterity is really, really important. And when you are confined to your apartment, confined to your room at assisted living in a nursing home, unable to go to common areas and socially interact with people around you, see your grandkids, et cetera, you lose that dexterity and flexibility and muscle tone really, really fast. And that the risk of doing that when you're elderly is far greater, and it sets in far more quickly than for most of us. So once people who were once used to a sort of baseline of physical capability try to get back to that after a year of inactivity, you're going to see, I think, more injuries. You're going to see people who are trying to overperform their physical capability just because they don't know how much they've lost. So you end up in a situation where you might see more falls, you might see more strains, things like that. And I think that getting back to things sort of slowly but surely, as you can restart physical therapy and start going to the dining room and assisted living and things like that, is going to be really important to make sure that the elderly have already sacrificed so much during the pandemic, more than most of us. And in order to keep them from losing more, I think that a sort of slow but sure return to activity is really important instead of just diving back in.
Amanda, of course, as people are beginning to feel these physical side effects from being isolated and being indoors for a year, essentially, some people, including myself, will say, well, I think I have to go get this checked out. That also requires a calculation of risk, leaving home to go to an office to get physical therapy or get acupuncture, for example, or any of the things that you might be thinking of, because you have to come in contact with people. And so is the fact that people are maybe wary about going to seek medical help right now for physical ailments making this even worse?
Yes. All of the doctors I spoke with expressed a lot of anxiety about people skipping care that might be essential or that might, you know, show up down the line as something they should have done. I spoke to one cardiologist in particular who said that, especially towards the beginning of the pandemic, they were seeing people come in who had had heart attacks, who were waiting till the very, very last minute to seek care. And some of those people were at that point too sick to help. So there are a lot of serious things that are going on with people's health that have nothing to do with the coronavirus specifically. So if you put off seeking care for something else because you're afraid of COVID, it could have extraordinarily serious implications for your health. It could kill you. And trying to make that calculation is so, so difficult, because for a lot of people who already have existing health problems, the risk of getting COVID is very acute, and what it could do to their bodies is also very, very serious. So I don't envy anybody in that position of being in some sort of serious pain and trying to hedge about whether or not this is something that's serious enough to risk another deadly problem. It's very, very difficult to parse what people are supposed to do in that situation.
The social isolation has really also limited what we're able to do. I, for example, enjoy swimming. Being able to do that in a pandemic is really difficult. How else has social isolation affected our bodies? If there is a mind-body connection, isn't there, Amanda?
Yes. Social isolation, even before the pandemic, there was a lot of research about how social isolation degrades people's physical health, makes premature mortality much more likely, and just generally, you know, degrades people's well-being. And that functions in a lot of ways. Like the routines that we go through to keep ourselves together, basically our physical activities, our hygiene activities, our taking our medication and things like that, those habits are all socially rewarded. So if we can keep on top of all of that, we get all of the psychological benefit of seeing people and going and having social interactions and things like that, positive things. We don't have a lot of that reinforcement right now. So you get people who just, you know, sort of spiral. They fall into despair. They have a hard time keeping up with their medication, keeping up with their hygiene, things like that. But then you also have the sort of second order effects of social isolation helps people understand when they are not doing as well as they could. When you're just inside your head all the time and you're alone all the time, you might not notice changes in your posture. You might not notice changes in your breathing, changes in your physical fitness, because those things degrade over time. Whereas if you see someone, you know, a couple times a week, a neighbor or something like that, even doesn't have to be somebody close, that person has the opportunity to go, your breathing seems a little bit labored. Are you okay? You know, have you been feeling okay? So it just provides sort of like this external check on you and your well-being that is very hard for some people to do for themselves, especially as you get older and more things start to go wrong. Keeping track of all those things and where they are can be a little bit difficult. So that external social interaction provides a lot of help to people in keeping track of their own health and deciding when they need to seek care. And if you don't have that, then you're just sort of flying solo, trying to make those decisions yourself, which is really difficult.
You mentioned insurance, and I'm sure there are people, we know that tens of thousands of Americans have lost their jobs during this pandemic. And I imagine that also has the stress from that also has a physical effect. But not having insurance to be able to go to the doctor is probably also keeping a lot of folks away, not just frontline workers, but just anyone who's lost their job right now.
Right. Our healthcare system does not encourage people to seek care for anything, basically. Even if you have good insurance, it can be extraordinarily stressful to figure out how much a procedure is going to cost you, if you can go to a particular specialist to seek help on a particular problem. So if you take away even the baseline of insurance from that, and if somebody loses a job, they don't just lose their insurance, but they lose their income. So basically, you lose both of the components that you need in order to seek medical care in the United States. And so people delay, and that can be very, very dangerous.
Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three, before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That's it. Anywhere on the planet you are.
The LAPD may have some explaining to do after an employee reported that police officers were sharing a fake Valentine's card that mocked the death of George Floyd. Eyewitness News reporter Josh Haskell has the story.
An internal LAPD investigation is underway into whether a department employee created or shared an offensive Valentine's Day message that mocked the death of George Floyd. The message reportedly showed a photo of Floyd with the words, "You take my breath away."
There's no room for mocking anyone's death, especially someone who died at the hands of police in Minnesota.
Over the weekend, an LAPD employee reported seeing the image, told his superiors, and was interviewed by the department Monday. But the LAPD tells Eyewitness News they have not seen the image even after a workplace survey was conducted. In a tweet, the department said they will have zero tolerance for this type of behavior.
It's scary knowing that we have racists who might come into our community and be in charge of policing black people. It's scary knowing that people have that mindset that they can mock someone's murder. This man had a foot on his neck for over 8 minutes and died at the hands of the police, and yet someone within the LAPD thinks it was funny.
And George Floyd's family isn't laughing either. Family attorney Ben Crump said the Floyd family is understandably outraged. This is beyond insult on top of injury. It's injury on top of death. The type of callousness and cruelty within a person's soul needed to do something like this evades comprehension and is indicative of a much larger problem within the culture of the LAPD. The allegations the post has been shared or was created by an LAPD employee are still being looked at, and it's not clear it was viewed at the workplace.
L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon says that if true, this could create trust issues with the community that could decrease the likelihood of someone reporting a crime. The police union also repudiated the possible existence of what they call an abhorrent image.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 20, 2021. So I have been told. Thank you all for your patience. I thought I had timed things perfectly. I had to retrieve my pumpkin pie from the oven. I thought I had timed it so I could get it out of the oven before we went live. And I looked and was like, oh, it's got to be in there an hour. Needed an extra 60 seconds. So we did our little commercial right on counterracism.com. So much to share for this week's compensatory call-in. We'll be here tomorrow for our Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Also, tomorrow is actually 12 years to the day of our return to the air. A dozen years of attempted counter-racist broadcasting. Not that we have succeeded in solving the problem. But that is tomorrow, so we'll say a word on that. And then mostly just normal business for the Global Sunday Talk. This will actually be the first time that we speak to our international participants since President Biden has taken office, to hear about the transition as well as what is the vaccine rollout looking in different parts of the world. That'll be tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 p.m. Pacific. We will look forward to checking in with our different folks around the world. Might even have some international participants today, be in Toronto and others. Let's see. 12 years listener supported counter-racist radio. That in and of itself, I hope, out of the many, many, many investors over the years, a dozen of them, I hope we have been constructive more often than not. Solving the problem of white supremacy racism is pretty challenging. So I wish there were smarter folks than myself who were willing to invest in trying to solve this problem. Hopefully there are. But wow, it has been, it has not been an enjoyable, fun dozen years of counter-racist work, but again, hopefully we've helped a few folks get a better understanding of what racism is, how it works, and some things that non-white people, victims of racism, can and should be doing to solve this problem. To invest, you can hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. I will have to collate, so there'll be a new post with all of the O.J. Simpson book club study session. Like, wow, it'll be so rich with information. So that can be just in one spot for people who want to check out the O.J. Simpson content. And I guess we'll have great addendums, because then we'll have when F. Lee Bailey was on the program, and Steven Singular and Patrick J. McKenna, and probably some other folks as we stay tuned. But that'll be awesome. So that'll be posted right now. The post is Isabel Wilkerson, review of Cased, second worst book ever. And even question mark, because I feel like Jeffrey Toobin, like, this is the most deceptive book I've ever read. That should weigh heavily in a system of white supremacy where the primary weapon is deception. If you read a book that is rife with deception and it's supposed to be accurate, this is not fiction, this is nonfiction, and it is rife with deception, that should weigh heavily on how you evaluate a book. Jeff Toobin, The Run of His Life, O.J. Simpson. The conclusion is this Thursday. Everything we have invested leading up, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Boris Johnson was saying that this week. He was mocking that this week. I can't wait to ask the folks tomorrow about that. He was mocking that this week, saying he couldn't get the gloves on for the vaccine. It's like O.J. Simpson here. Doesn't fit. Triple T. Doesn't fit, you must acquit. But for right now, Cased, that is the top post on the blog. Isabel Wilkerson, Cowbell. You can check that out when you visit racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. My Cash App is linked there as well. cash.app/$thecows. Again, enormous gratitude to a dozen years of listeners who have kept the cows rolling, hopefully, again, worthy of the past 12 years or however long you have been listening, calling in to the cows. Also, our wish list at Amazon.com, linked under Gus T. Renegade. Super, super gratitude and thanks to all of the folks who have nabbed an item or three over the years. Man, oh man. Hopefully we can continue on the counter-racist grind if it is constructive. Now, as I said, the list of notes to share. Most of the time when we have reports, I'll have a thought or two or three. I think pretty much every report, like this is one of the lengthier audio segments that we've had for the compensatory call-in. And even the people that listen to the archive, you didn't even hear all of the news clips because I had one that I said, man, I shouldn't play this. And then I listened to it and I said, oh yeah, we have to play this, but I'm not adding this because that'll just, you can't play everything. So I played it kind of right at the beginning for people who are right here at the beginning, very beginning, 9 p.m. on the dot. You heard it. It was talking about being right down the road from Gus T. Renegade in Oregon, a non-white person with a white parent. They had a Black Lives Matter sign in the front yard and it was vandalized. And so they were obstinate. They put it back and it was stolen again. And this time when it was stolen, the perpetrator replaced it with a watermelon with BLM stenciled in the rind. How could I not play that? I didn't play. You only heard it if you were listening like kind of early. You heard it. I've been talking about that. I said, number one, I strongly discourage having any sort of Black Lives Matter paraphernalia in your front lawn or in your windowsill as a decal on your vehicle. None of that. In fact, if it was you had a sign that said hashtag RWSWJ or even you spelled it out, replace white supremacy with justice. And none of that, in my view, is constructive. That is not helpful towards solving problems. If anything, it will exactly what happened there, if not worse. It's been tons of those reports, particularly, I would say, over the last year since the Rona, since people are outraged and stressed and they got their new firearms. Oh, we'll just shoot at the niggers with the Black Lives Matter sign in the yard. It's been lots of those incidents. No paraphernalia in the yard. Just go about your business. You'll probably be mistreated anyway. Lots of those reports for Black people who do not have counter-racist paraphernalia on their lawn. Next, to the reports that we did hear. I played the segment about hair loss. Talk about another one. Now, they did directly mention racism in the segment and talking about the impact on non-white females, Black females specifically, the past year of stress, strife, racism has caused hair loss. I said, interesting. We'll have to see if folks think that's accurate. I do know it's been stressful, so that could be. But then within that, when I'll be thinking like, should I play this? They went to one of the callers and she said, man, I've lost so much hair. It's enough to make a coon coat. Oh, yeah. Let that one ride. Let's play that one. And then folks can chime in and see maybe that's accurate because I do know that the last year has been super stressful. I put the clip about hair loss together with the segment about the impact this past year of being inside, locked down, all the rest of it, and how that has impacted our bodies. Super important as well, even though I know a lot of non-white people have not had the great fortune to just say, hunker down and be inside. A lot of us have been forced to still go outside for a variety of reasons. But even with that, the past year and all of the stress and still being restricted to some degree, even if you are still going out for whatever reasons. It has had a big impact on lots of people that I even know directly who have talked about having increased anxiety, increased stress, weight gain, difficulty sleeping, just the whole gambit for lots of reasons for so many folks over the last year, so many folks all over the world, parenting and all the rest of it within that. So just many things that were talked about in that segment, posture and even how the last year, because if you're not in an office and you're having to kind of piecemeal a home office situation and you might not have the most comfortable seating arrangement or a desk because you weren't, you know, prepared to be doing this extensive work from home for so long, and how that can impact posture and being sedentary for a long period of time. Whew, when I heard that, like I said, I know people directly who, you know, are dealing, have been struggling with a lot of those issues over the past year and the direct impact on their body. And I just, I am so thankful to have had yoga come into my existence before all of this. I think it would have I think I probably would have gained about 500 pounds because I switched my diet right when I began practicing yoga. So if I wasn't doing yoga, I probably would still be eating, you know, Funyuns, Cheetos, potato chips, all the rest of the drinking sodas, ice cream. Like I would have been, I told you I just got my pie out of the oven. Vegan, non-dairy, but yeah, I would have just been eating nonsense, regular old pie. No, I would have gained about 500 pounds, like easily, like just sitting around over the last year, eating nonsense and being stressed, and man, easily. I was just so thankful because you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to worry about the gym and all the rest of it. You can get in a workout and feel good, and being an instructor. So I've been able to teach black students, no less, so that they can move around, break a sweat, gain some strength, get some flexibility in. Just that is so important. I think we've talked a lot over the past year about if you can still get outside, do some hiking or some running, that sort of thing, or do some exercise in your residence. It is super, super important. Self-care is a core component of counter-racism. We've talked about that at all of the retreats. Let's see. The segment where they talked about the past year and the racism against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, I thought of Dr. Welsing, and she added to the 10 stops. One of her adds to the 10 stops is stop allowing racists to have black people, yellow people, red people, and brown people squabbling and in conflict with each other. She said that on this platform many times and on many other platforms. That was one of the first things I thought of. I was reminded of Irie last week when she said they said someone was practicing racism against Asians. She said they could have just said practicing racism and then went on attacks against Asian people, blah, blah, blah. But just practicing racism, white supremacy. That's the system that we're in. I thought of that. That was just last week. I just read a report in Vice magazine. I thought of I've heard and read some people saying that they think this is this surge of reports. They said in the segment that we heard that this has not been talked about. I disagree. I've seen many, many reports, and we've played a number of them over the past year, not the past month, over the past year, all the way back when President Trump first came out into the it comes from China and the Kung Flu and all of that in March of last year. So I totally disagree with that. That is false. Anyway, I've heard a number and seen a number of folks saying that they think this is going to be recalibrated to say that, oh, it's black people engaging in these attacks and black people are attacking Asian people and blah, blah, blah. That could easily happen. Black people get accused of everything. They might even say that O.J. Simpson beat up and chopped up some Asian people. All of that said, I just checked Vice News and they had a report. New York just had 3 attacks against Asian Americans in the last 3 days. I scrolled down. The picture that they have of one of these perpetrators, he looks very much like a white man. Now, I could be totally wrong, but this for sure is not one where, oh, yes, this is, you know, O.J. Simpson or Lil Wayne or Kanye West. He's upset about the breakup and is out. No, this is clearly someone who would be classified as white, looks very much a melanin deficient male. if this is the guy, even if it wasn't, but if this is the guy, like, this is just another white terrorist, act of racism, white supremacy, I would categorize it as such. If they're targeting so-called Asian people, fine, add that to it. But yeah, I would just add this. This would be included in our normally weekly roundup of just white people terrorizing, practicing racism. No doubt President Trump and his conduct over the past year would not surprise me at all if that sort of thing is happening. It should just be pointed out. More aspects, more proof of the world, the system that we are trying to solve and get rid of. But I did, they say, even within all of that, they said that Asian people have been the most depressed over the last 12 months. That's the sort of thing where I hit the pause button. Bam, I'm going to need a citation for that. And even once I get the citation, like, ooh, we're going to have to read this one cover to cover. Don't miss one apostrophe. What kind of study did we do to evaluate this? Like, you went around, how even pause right there. Now, what do you mean when you say Asian? Does Kamala Harris count in that? We could stop right there when you make a statement like that. What do you mean exactly? And they even had a pause. I was waiting, like, is there a citation? Did somebody do a study? Is this? Let us know if it exists. I would love to check it out and do some investigating, but I didn't even hear that. Next, I do not want to hear anything about the Tuskegee syphilis study, experiment, experience for at least like a good year. I am so thankful we read Medical Apartheid, Harriet A. Washington, and we read it 5 years ago. Like, what does Professor Grist say? Get a late pass. And we had James H. Jones, who wrote the book, literally, Bad Blood, The Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, in the archives, 2013. He spent 2 hours and 15 minutes, and we talked about all of this. Is Nurse Rivers a coon? Is she a sellout? And all the rest of it, and Bill Clinton's lame apology and connectedness to AIDS. In the archives, all of that said, I do not want to hear anything about Tuskegee for like a good year. Like, all of this, I feel like, has been so lame. Like, I have not heard one constructive comment, I would almost say, from anyone, white or non. It would be a strain. I would really have to strain my mind almost every time. It has been something absolutely nonsensical, not constructive, a white person, non-white person, everybody. Every time it's devolved into name-calling other black people and making it a very narrow focus where the only name that gets attached to this is a black person, Nurse Rivers, which I find appalling. No white people get named or indicted in all of this. We get a lame cameo from Bill Clinton, suspected race soldier, and they confined it exclusively to Tuskegee. We talked about my alma mater, the University of Virginia. Forget what happened in the 20th century. We could have talked about the Coon Man. Governor of Virginia, medical doctor. He was in med school when all this with the photographs came out. Why not talk about that? Why not talk about, what was it, Dr. Susan Moore? End of 2020. Died from COVID-19. She didn't say it was fears about the Tuskegee syphilis experience or any other nonsense. She said it was white people who are in here practicing racism against me at the hospital. That's the problem that I have. Why not just talk about that? Henry, I mean, you could list lots of names. All of these reports and really anyone. I've had people who've sent me emails where black people have been talking about Tuskegee and COVID-19. And again, that oftentimes devolved into name calling and ugh. I'm disgusted with it all. I have a serious, what do they call it, eyebrow raise. If that's black people's excuse, even though most of the time when I hear black people, they don't seem to have a lot of detail. Like I don't bump into black people and say, oh, yeah, I read James Jones' book and I read Medical Apartheid and blah, 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 went down to the archives. Like, that's generally not what happens. But wait, white people are to blame for that. But whatever. Generally, it only gets brought up as black people don't want to get the Rona vaccine because of Tuskegee. I've not heard one report why white people been acting a fool since like the very beginning of this. What's their excuse? it's such a, just all of it. It's such a narrow focus in how it's presented. They don't even use correct words. As I said, they've been calling it Tuskegee Experience sometime and other goofy titles. I'm done with it all. I hope we don't hear any more of these. Really, that's the only reason I've been playing these reports. It's not that I agree with them or anything like that. It's just, wow, let me evaluate. This is so curious. I don't even know if that's a correct descriptor. It's so, one, it's saying the same thing consistently, without repeating what I just said, to just consistently locate black people as being suspicious because of this. And we need to go out and do our work to make sure that they take the vaccine while we haven't even addressed the Coon Man. Yeah, I'll leave it there. Let's see. UVA, I just mentioned my alma mater. I remember them talking about this. We sat out on the lawn for convocation and they talked about, yes, the slaves, and they had their quarters right over yonder, and they pointed to grassy knoll type area out on the field, and just be like, well, that is a great introduction. I'm ready to roll. I've heard enough. And they would do this. They would have like casual references. I think where one of the upper class dorms is, they have a, like a small placard. When I say small, like in the range of 8x11, like, you know, slice of paper type thing. But it would be, it was in the middle of like the trees and everything, like, oh yes, this is believed to have been slave quarters where they helped, you know, construct the cabins and all that. Maybe Thomas Jefferson came and did a little raping in this area. Have to go back and visit, see what the new monuments look like. The snow in Dallas, they had, we did not hear this report, but they did have reports where they talked about a disproportionate number of the people who lost electricity and are having water issues in the Texas area, not just Dallas, are non-white black people. No surprise there at all. The report we heard, however, they started out, they referenced these as blackouts, and you heard the white man said, well, we call these service interruptions. The term blackout has major implications. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. Because this is like serious. You have like thousands of people who are without power and people could be dying. Like, this is the sort of thing that if I did, or Mr. Fuller or somebody else talks about the importance of words, but like, what, you and your PC nonsense, I am trying to get my electricity back on and we've got people who could die without heat, and you're out here trying to be PC and doing all that. Like, on one, I could process that being said. And then I also was saying words are important, like absolutely, like, and it's always something bad with a blackout. And then they came right back within the same report, and he came with about 2 minutes later, because, and even the white man doing the interview, he said, oh, okay, so service interruptions, like, oh, what I was saying for the PCG. When he gets about 2 minutes later into the report, and he said, it seemed earlier you were suggesting some dark possibilities if this problem continues. And again, words are important. If it's going to be where every 30 seconds, every 60 seconds, it's dark day and black Monday, nigger Friday and black possibility, well, then yes, that should be pointed out and we should stop that. And particularly if the converse is going to be white collar crime and that sort of, yes. Yeah, people are going to say, we don't want to say congresswoman anymore and congressman. Let's remove the gender. Well, then we should for sure remove all of the anti-black references, even when we are talking about life-threatening situations, because, man, nothing is more life-threatening than white supremacy racism. Again, they said it was a disproportionate number of black and non-white people enduring the so-called blackouts and water service interruptions in Texas and other areas. Hope folks in that area are staying warm, safe. Whew, man, I can empathize. Let's see. The LAPD, they did the Valentine. This will be, that's why I said it was, I could have talked about all of the segments. Like, everything that I played this week had a deep resonance with me, at least. The LAPD, They have allegedly been caught sending some sort of meme, "You Take My Breath Away," for Valentine's Day this past weekend with George Floyd's image on it. In my studies of O.J. Simpson, I have heard a number of folks, some of them victims of racism, say, "Man, the LAPD has come such a long way since the days of Mark Furman." GED Mark Furman, by the way, has come such a long way. I mean, why, they're so much more progressive than they were in 1995. Mark Furman, we just heard that part in the Furman tapes. The people in the book club, he bragged about the chokehold. We just read that 2 days ago in Jeff Toobin. He bragged about the choke. I loved it. Oh, he said, "I think I probably choked out 150. Man, I didn't even think." We just read that. He bragged, was upset. He said, we had, that's in the Furman tapes. He said, "We had the chokehold, but the niggers went down and complained." That's why I said it is disgraceful. We've been here for 12 years. And if you had asked me what's on the Furman tapes, no idea. Brags about choking niggers. Nostalgia, not just one, not a dozen. I think he said like 100. But they've come a long way since then. And you heard in the segment, if they can locate the Mark Furman metaphor who was sharing this this meme, he will be terminated. That's what they said 25 years ago. Anyway, for this broadcast, no metaphors. If we could be direct, specific with what we would like to say, that would be appreciated. Race soldiers, they are extraordinary at using metaphors to confound, practice deception. They will take two separate entities and insist that they are identical, exactly the same. Frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims, myself included, we've been exposed to this for a long time, more than a dozen years. And many of us are also still learning. As such, we don't have all the logic sometimes to articulate our views. Sometimes we will substitute an analogy, metaphor of some sort, figure of speech. Frequently, that just contributes to more confusion. If we could make an effort to be precise, exact, specific with what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. If we could take about 5 minutes to share our thoughts, observations, that would be great. Just make sure that everyone gets at least one chance to speak. And then if you have additional thoughts to add in, just make sure that everyone has shared one time, and then you can rejoin if you have a question or suggestion to offer. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you know you're in a noisy area, if you could get to someplace that's somewhat quiet, that would be appreciated, just so that we don't have to compete with the unnecessary background noise. Much obliged. I think we might even have a caller from Japan listening in. I'll add him to my line so he can join us as well. Just one more I forgot. Make sure that I get in. I was stunned. I'm ignorant, still learning about many things. One thing I learned: Prince Markie D and Rush Limbaugh passed this week. I didn't even include that. We could have had easily like 2.5 hours of just news segments. Rush Limbaugh, suspected race soldier, passed away this week. Prescription drug abuser and all the rest of it. He died. Incidentally, he had, going back to OJ, we talked about that Thursday. But we did not even recognize Rush Limbaugh passing. Additionally, Prince Markie D of the Fat Boys died this week. I was surprised they put up the obituary. I was like, "Oh, the Fat Boys, I remember. Terrible." And I just gave a glance and they said, "Oh, he died at 52. It's like, 52? Like, whoa, that is crazy. Like, and then I doubled. I was like, "Wait a minute, did I look at that wrong? Maybe it said 72, or which would not be much better, but I mean." So then I went back and looked again. They said, 52? Like, gee, like, I think we talked about that last year. We had the clip where they talked about all of these black male hip-hop artists who end up dying at really young ages, where it's absolutely like this, 52 years old, like, what is going on? White supremacy racism, not black male privilege. Black misandry, if you want to be specific. But I saw that, and I just said, wow, like, 52? And then I was really stunned, because I said, well, how old was he when... So I was trying to go back and said, oh, so I should think of the Fat Boys as a child group. Oh, not in my process. Not that I needed to go back and reevaluate the Fat Boys, but oh, they're teens. I thought they were adults for some reason. Child group. Okay. Totally different way of thinking about things. But if anything, eating correctly, taking care of your health, very important. 52 years old, disgraceful indictment of the system of white supremacy. Folks who dialed in with commentary, line should be open. Let's see. I'll see if we have our caller in Japan with us first, and then I'll nab the other folks as well. Might have him in. Let's give him a moment to get settled. Are you with us, sir? Still getting settled in? Might still be getting settled in. We'll check again. If you're with us, sir, not able to hear you.
Hello?
Yep. Oh, got you that time.
I'm sorry. I'm listening online, and there's a time delay, so actually two conversations at once. But good to hear you. Good to be heard.
For sure. Glad to have you on. You're joining us from Japan. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Wow.
I've been listening to your show, I think, now for about a year or so. I've tried to connect a few times, but I'm not so computer savvy, you know, and so I was having trouble, but finally got it through, and so I'm happy to talk to you. Thank you.
For sure. I don't know. Folks might have a question or two about how the Rona is proceeding there. If you want to get settled in and then share your thoughts on what you heard, we can check in with a few of the folks who dialed in, and yeah, I'm sure they might have a question or two. Exactly what is going down with the Rona, your side of the world, or other thoughts. Let's see. Some of the folks who dialed in, I guess I'll get Mo in Dallas. Again, hope you are warm, have water, can flush your toilet, can take a bath. Hope you and, in fact, your family, friends are doing as well as can be under the circumstances, and hope it gets warm there so that that can, you know, help solve some problems. Did you have commentary, sir?
Yes, I do. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you, guys. greetings, listeners and callers. As always, thank you for the program. I'll address the issues in Dallas at the end of my short spiel, if I can. I came in a little behind, so I didn't actually get to catch the Black Lives Matter paraphernalia on the lawn being replaced with the watermelon. But I can say that I've spoken, I believe, on this program about how I am personally against victims of racism having just anything that identifies you as a victim of racism in your yard, just because, you know, you could be targeted by anyone who's passing by your home. And on a more personal level, I've actually had conflicts in my own household, you know, for these things. There are certain flags and signage that a cohabitant would like to display, and I had to explain to her the reason why that would be potentially dangerous. Any victims of racism, please, if you are considering displaying anything, be cautious. You know, be conscious of your area that you're in, and also be aware that you don't know who's driving past your home, you know, and just that easily you can end up like literally like with, I'm sorry to say it, but a firebomb being thrown through your window. It might not just be a watermelon. As far as the hair segment, I noted that the trichologist said that there may be a couple of things that males suffer from that could promote hair loss. I want any male that listens to that segment to understand that hair loss is a people problem. You know, so if you consider yourself a person, just re-listen to that segment and understand that stress, you know, diet, like your work at home situation, all of those can promote your hair loss as well. I don't want males to think that there are only a couple of reasons that, you know, you can lose your hair. And I'm speaking from experience with that too. I have a son who is 11 now, and he didn't have hair issues, but what he did have was nerve issues, and those nerve issues actually had him pulling out his hair at one point. You know, so me and his mom had to really sit down and talk to him about, you know, what he was going through, and as well as nurture our relationship between each other, because our child was suffering on some level and we didn't understand it. I also have a short list of vitamins that I myself take. I take spirulina. I take colloidal silver, powderized kelp, ashwagandha, biotin, and castor oil. Like, I do those. And it's helped with my overall health, along with my hair growth. The LAPD and George Floyd, the Valentine, you take my breath away. When I heard that, I heard of it maybe a week back, actually. And I thought of, the Ahmaud Arbery situation, about how that the video of him being murdered was circulated for months on end before it actually was, I guess, leaked, if you would say that, to the general public. And I also noted that I heard the reporter said that this would promote trust issues in the Los Angeles Police Department. But I noted that there was no real punishment listed or sounded like it was even planned for whoever started this or whoever participated in the circulation of these photos of George Floyd. Just like, in my opinion, there was no real punishment associated with the Ahmaud Arbery murder situation, or tragedy. I wouldn't say situation, tragedy. As far as Dallas, during this blizzard, Texas would consider this a blizzard. We didn't understand how ill prepared we were. Like when it comes to the state of Texas, like it is usually hot and humid here, so the houses are built, you know, to conserve cool energy. You know, like we don't have basements. We have large front windows a lot of the time, so houses aren't really close together. We don't have salt trucks on hand. We don't have sand trucks, you know, because it's not a natural occurrence for us to receive an inch of snow, you know, in any given year. It's cold here. You know, it gets cold, but we don't really get the winter humidity. So this really... was just a shock to the system of Texas. I believe there was a 105 car pileup on our Interstate 35 West in Fort Worth. And there was video of it. Like people in Texas don't have snow tires, like, or chains on the tires or anything like that. So you can see, like, That's several videos on the internet of cars just full blown, like going 60 miles an hour into a 30 car pileup, and it's just building. You can hear them cracking one after another. Me, fortunately, I've invested in a couple of things since the quarantine started, like a purified water fountain system. I've been stockpiling rice, you know, things like that. We try to stay stocked on fruit and just a few canned vegetables if we can. Fortunately for me, I wasn't as hit as hard when it came to this short lived blizzard, which by the way is almost completely melted. Texas should be back to, I guess, normal functions for the winter soon. But it was still a trying issue for me. A lot of my friends live in majority non-white black areas, and they were hit way harder by this issue than I was. I'm fortunate enough to live within, I think, like a mile from a hospital and 3 miles from a police station. So I'm on a specific power grid in Texas. So my power could not be manipulated because you would run the risk of shutting down either a hospital or a police station. I'm like set dead in between them. But people that don't have the proximity to those particular places of operation were not so fortunate. So we've had people freezing. I've invited people over my house to, you know, shower. I lost my heat. There are major, like, you can see parasites in the water from pouring them in the glass. So it has really been a trying issue in Texas. And Texas really was upset at Ted Cruz for flying to Cancun, so upset that he actually flew back and explained that he did it for his kids. And there was an interesting meme floating around saying Senator Ted Cruz went to Cancun in support of his children. And the response to the other portion of that meme says, so we should cross borders to protect our children. And I thought that was in relation to the young man out of Grand Prairie who he was 14 at the time, and he murdered a family in a car accident. And he ended up fleeing to Mexico. His name escapes me, and I don't like that his name escapes me, but it does. Hopefully one of the other callers can remember his name. But he murdered a family of four driving drunk. I think he was 13 or 14, and his mother took him to Mexico. It was a lot like the Kenosha shooting. That's all I have for now. Meet my line. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Again, hope folks are black self-respect, trying to invite some folks in to help out. Hopefully the heat is back and all the rest. But yeah, I'd heard lots of just horrendous things about the water supply in the Texas region. Like, man, reminded me of Flint. Other folks and other regions, Newark, New Jersey, other regions as well. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello. May I be heard?
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Otep, how you doing? I know, right? Poorly. It's glad you're here for another show. And hello to all the people on the line. I'm trying to figure out if I'm mistaken it for this show or another show, but I think I heard on this show that someone reported, or there was a clip of people reporting hearing sirens in Texas a couple months ago that sounded like the sirens from
The Purge.
That movie, The Purge. Yep.
And then this happens.
Yes.
And then this happens. So I think, I don't know, nothing's coincidence. Don't know why that happened, but I would say it's not a coincidence that, you know, this is happening with the, what did he call it, the whatever he called the blackouts. Yeah, just interesting. When the tri-collegist, I've never heard of that until now. I'm sorry if I got it mixed up. When she was talking about hair loss, I just found it interesting that, I mean, it was a good segment, but I found it interesting that white people are interested in us losing hair. In general, there's a fascination with our hair. And then also I wondered if part of it was because of them kind of reinforcing, you know, black women being bald or not being able to grow their hair for one reason or another, you know. But what the doctor was saying is true about stress, journaling. I've been journaling, and I found that, you know, it's true when you write stuff down and manifest. I've been journaling about spiritual things, discoveries, ponderances, and also about economics with my business. I started journaling different things that I was thinking about doing, and also meetings that I've been having with a mentor that's pretty successful in business, and I've had some success since I've been doing that. So I think she's correct with journaling. Also to relieve stress or find your source of stress. And she mentioned the DHT. There are supplements anyone can take to block the testosterone that would block the, you know, the testosterone that blocks the hair follicle from coming out of the scalp. But the important thing is, you can take vitamins for your hair, but if you're deficient in other parts of your body, the vitamins or the supplements will go to the deficiency first, which leads me to the segment about overall health that they were speaking of and the hair article. You know, I don't think it's been said enough in these articles about how people that have chronic unemployment or underemployment, what their food intake is like. I'm sure people aren't really able to make good food choices when they don't have enough money or they're not eating enough. And if you're not eating enough, again, whatever you do eat, if it does have any nutritional value, it'll go to a deficiency first before it'll go to your skin and hair. So people, if they can, they just really need to focus on eating as much living foods and supplementing if they can afford it as much as possible. Let's see. And then her talking about hair made me think of when I was teaching 2 years ago, there was a young lady with long locks, long, light brown locks, very pretty. She had curled them, kind of looked like the style that the group Chloe and Haley would wear with their locks. Curled on themselves, very pretty. And this white lady walked up to her, "Oh my God, your hair is just so long." And she is stroking this young woman. It's a simile, but she's stroking her like an exotic cat. "Oh, it's so pretty. It's so long." And I wanted to tell that young lady, please don't let anyone touch your hair. Your hair is an antenna for energy. You know, I wanted to tell her that I didn't get a chance to. And I'm not even sure she would have been receptive, honestly, because I'm more than sure it's not the first time this woman put her hands in this lady, young lady's hair. But, yeah, it's a lot of malnutrition, I'm sure, among non-white people right now. And then the other thing about health with posture, muscle pains and stuff, I tell everyone I know, especially young people, I say it just like this: if you don't use your body, you'll lose your body.
So being sedentary definitely isn't good. People need to stretch. At minimum, they need to stretch, you know, do yoga. I've been doing yoga more since Corona was an issue. And I find that I have way less problems. But I also notice, and they don't talk about this as a health aspect for non-white people, and I suspect it's because they know most non-white people can't afford these treatments. But chiropractic care, I believe, is an essential part of maintaining your health, because we can get out of adjustment with our body parts. My right hip is higher than my left, so I have to adjust myself with stretching and yoga, but I also, whenever I can't, go to a chiropractor to reset the joints, and also massage. And massage most of the time is not covered by your health insurance. And I would, when I was substituting, I would actually substitute like an extra like 2 or 3 days a week to be able to afford at least twice a month massage sessions that cost between $100 or $145 for like a 90-minute session. Because, I mean, I guess 30 minutes could help someone, but to me, I think at least an hour deep tissue massage would be the most therapeutic thing. And like I said, insurance doesn't cover that. But most of the time, you have to pay. I had to pay for it. And whenever I went to get a massage, it was all white people in there getting massage. And when I was at the chiropractor, most of the time, people would get adjustments when they were had an accident and, you know, it was part of a lawsuit. But after that, they wouldn't go back. They wouldn't pay for the chiropractic care themselves because they couldn't afford it. So I just wanted to add those things. Thank you very much for letting me speak, and have a great evening, everybody. Hotel.
Much obliged, Irie. Excellent suggestions about diet, overall health. Glad that we've had at least two folks who mentioned that about diet with regards to not just hair health and skin health, but overall health, which I think having that, as they call, holistic view of health is much more important. More yoga for everybody. More yoga for everybody. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. 5 minutes. 5 minutes. Folks can take 5 minutes.
Rob Yard.
Rob in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, the host, callers, and listeners. I'm just getting off the plantation, so I didn't get a chance to hear the clips. But listening to the commentary, I thought it was very interesting that it was a segment surrounding hair today. Workplace. Can I be heard?
I think we lost you for a bit. You said I found it interesting that there was a segment about hair, and then I didn't hear you for a second. Okay. And then I heard you again. You said workplace, and then I didn't hear you. So maybe you want to try it again.
So with the segment talking about hair, I had a workplace in. I really don't know what to term it, but I had a sort of an awkward interaction at work today surrounding hair. So I've been wearing a afro, a pretty nice size afro. And so yesterday I got a haircut, and now I'm wearing a high top fade. And few people told me that the haircut looks pretty nice looking haircut. And so I go to work today, and I was called Will Smith and Kid from Kid and Play. And so in the moment when these when I was called, when I was referred to as these people, I laughed it off and kind of took it as a compliment, right? And throughout the workday, watching everybody work and just observing the situation, I took those comments referring to me as those people, I took it as mistreatment, because simply I haven't been referred to those people before, and why not just refer to my haircut as, or to my hair, just simply it looks nice or whatever. And looking at, and so like the hairstyle that I'm wearing, the high top fade, what I noticed is that a lot of the non-white Asian males wear this same style haircut. And I didn't, you know, I started to pick up on that as the day went on. And I was looking at their hair as I was thinking about mine. And, you know, my hair is sticking like straight up, pointing towards the sky. And their hair is, even though it's in the same style, it's flat, you know, it's, you know, we don't have the same hair. And like Nellie Fuller said, hair is just hair. And I found it very interesting that people made those comments to me. And I just kind of felt like people were staring at me today, throughout the day. And that's all I have right now. Thanks for listening.
Wow. Rob in California, a.k.a. Will Smith. Workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Have we had a few of those where they come in and pick which rapper you look like? Tacky every time. Even though he said, unless I misheard, he said he thought it was a compliment and then had some perhaps more thoughts about it. I love hair is just hair. That's why I try to give out recommendations, at least for the workplace, in terms of why I talk about outfit, which is not quite hair, although it's kind of close. But outfits and clothes and things like, hey, just have the same thing. You do not want anything to be said about your clothing at work, like zero conversations about attire. Let's just focus on, you know, the work that we're doing. It can't even just be, oh, wow, you got a haircut. Wow, Rob, that looks awesome. Nope. Oh my gosh, Will Smith is it? Yeah. Andy said lots of other folks seem to have this haircut. Like, do they get the same? Woo, man, oh man. Workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Which rapper do you look like? Apparently that's for Black History Month. Which rapper do you look like? Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Good evening. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, Gus. Good evening, listeners. Good evening, callers. Mo in Dallas, just as a refresher, the person you're referring to is Ethan Couch, if you haven't figured out the identity of that person. And it's interesting that he actually introduced a new term called Afro-Winter in his defense. So I'm glad you brought that up. I hope you're doing well. A question for everybody who cares to answer. Gus, the past few programs dealing with the insurrection, and you brought on the authors, I find it fascinating. I want to ask if, in terms of which books to read, like I know you read you read Mr. Tillman, the biography of Mr. Tillman, and The Hands of Persons Unknown was the author. And then there was another one I wanted to look into. Which one would readers, persons who have read the book, in order to get further understanding of the ideas of this white mob violence, which book would you read first? I'm trying to get a further understanding of that. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Might pull a Dr. Welsing and just say, read them all. Yeah, I would read them both. If you have them both, yeah, they're both pretty good. Like, I wouldn't even just read them both. It's probably a coin toss. I wouldn't really, prioritize. I didn't prioritize. I think I read the Ben Tillman. We read that in the book club, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, just because I had that book in hand before I got, Philip Dre's At the Hands of Persons Unknown. But I mean, his book mentions that one, you know, that's what I mean. They're talking about the same, period of time. Yeah, it's, there are probably some other, there are lots of good books on, rioting. We even read, Sundown Towns, is a good Buried in the Bittered Water, by Elliot Jaspin. He was a guest in 2010. That's another good, there are lots of, if you're trying to learn about the spirit and history of white mob violence, that's those four very good starts. And yeah, just take your pick. And they self-reference, they reference each other within that. So yeah, I think have fun. Yeah, if you have them already, you will not go wrong, either one that you start. And if you start with the Ben Tillman one, you'll have an immediate reference because we did the book club on that. So, and then if you go Philip Dre, he was just on the program. So, yeah, can't lose either way. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, suggestions, thoughts to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. If anybody wants to get a good example on how gestures that are symbolic can cause more problems. Recall the history of two world-class athletes who raised their fists with gloves on at the 1968 Olympics, and for 30 years or more, they had trouble with employment. One of the guy's wife committed suicide, and the harassment and terror from that incident contributed towards her death. So if just something that you really want to think about attempting to do, and it probably won't be worth it. I'm talking about Tommy Smith and John Carlos, if anyone hasn't guessed it by now. They're also supposed to be having another documentary on details of their suffering after the 1968 Olympics that lasted for well over 30 years or more. DCS program. Today we had three guests that came in and presented to the young fellows. Two of them were attorneys. One of the attorneys, his name was Gordon Weeks. He is the chief public defender in Broward County. He didn't so much talk about his work as a quote-unquote attorney. He talked about his own personal life and his attempts to gain employment and his schooling background. He trained. He went into his first venture was to become a airline mechanic. He's qualified to be a mechanic as far as with airplane engines as well as automobile engines. And then he went to Florida Memorial and was qualified to be a – I had it right on the tip of my tongue. I can't remember exactly air traffic controller. Yes. He qualified to become an air traffic controller, and then he went to law school. That position that he's in is an elected position in Broward County. Before that, he was in charge of the juvenile division as an attorney in Broward County. And with him was a younger black male who he basically has been encouraging to one day supersede him in that position and encouraged the young fellows to come up with their own ideas and pursue them. Also, we had a credit score official that she comes every year. Her name is Miss Roll, and she talked to the fellows about the stock market, having quote unquote good credit, as well as some other financial understandings. So they would minimize their problems that non-white people have financially under a global system of racism and white supremacy, and be as prosperous as possible under the circumstances. And so it was pretty fruitful day in that light. And thank you for everybody for listening. Thank you.
Bravo. Bravo. Financial literacy and get some folks talking about that's STEM, as they call it. Get some aviators and folks out there studying the sciences. Absolutely love it. Spectacular. Work with the young folks. Retired firefighter in Florida.
I've had a bald head since 1990. Completely bald.
No hair issues there. Right on. Let's see. Other folks who have dialed in, if you have a hand up, *61. If we missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening. Chris Markey D, from the Fab Boys, rest in peace. One of the gimmick raps at the early inception of hip hop trying to make its way to the mainstream. Two out of three of the Fab Boys are dead.
passed away. Man, you know, I don't have much more to say than that. Black people being accused, I find that they're focusing this, these accusations on this anti-Asian violence. A lot of it is using black people's pictures or kind of the way they position the news broadcast and things. It fits into the right in the log of, you know, look what this black person did and look what that black person did. And then here's this crime to an Asian right in that line. In 2020, there was 838 active hate groups that were counted in the United States. 72 alone were in California. Well, I don't think too many of these hate groups are targeting Asian people. I know black people aren't, so I don't get it. And they put out the statistics in November 2020 on Statistica for the hate crimes in 2019. So I guess we'll get 2020 numbers in November 2021. But number one on the list was black people, 2,391 crimes. And I think that's really undercounted because a lot of things I consider hate crimes, they don't seem to charge white people with. And as far as the Asians, it's 215. So, I mean, you're talking about a drastic difference. Not that much where I can see the president having to make an executive order about it. I mean, 2,391, I would see an executive order for that. So it just seems like they're doing something, white people, and I'm just watching them with how they position these Asians. I don't know. It's the coronavirus. Man, they're using preachers now to preach the propaganda. Black people need testing. Black people need vaccines. Now they're calling black people on their phones and mandating testing and quarantines because they may have come in contact with a person that tested positive or using their cell phones. They've already done this twice to my wife. So, it seems to be targeting black people. That's what I'm seeing from this coronavirus. Globalization mandates, of course, from the most powerful white people, these blackouts. You have a totally energy-independent state like Texas, plenty of natural gas, oil, gasoline, coal. They were forced to keep up with the mandates and convert up to 20% of their power grid to green energy by 2021, green energy being wind, solar, hydro, battery, etc. So that 20% freezes over, and the 80% that's left that always has worked, the oil, the coal, the gas, is not enough to supply the rest of the state. So they have to cut off certain parts of the grid to keep it working. And this is what's going to happen in 2025. When that green energy is mandated to be 50% of the grid, what happens when we have a snowstorm then? And what happens in Chicago and New York? I mean, where it's cold most of the year here. So this green energy thing that they've been pushing through this Green New Deal. And 5 years ago, this wanted to happen in Texas. But they were forced to take fully, perfectly functioning parts of their grid and converted to these green energy, and now that green energy freezes over and the rest of the grid is all vulnerable. Same thing happened in California when the fires burnt down the windmills and stuff, and their whole grid had to shut. They had rolling blackouts and brownouts all throughout the state. Hair loss, distress, I think it leads to depression. Distress is depressing. Black people, I see it a lot. I see people either lost a lot of weight or gained a lot of weight. Nothing's been open for months here. No school, no work. You're home all day with the people who annoy you the most. You know what I'm saying? Your favorite stores and restaurants are out of business. You know, I mean, prices of everything is going out. That the protests that you've seen the guy getting choked to death every day for hours, a whole summer. I mean, this was totally depressing. And to even talk about George Floyd getting choked to death, the LAPD. You know, we're talking about the police force that allowed a non-high school graduate to become a lead detective. And, you know, like this, I think that their level of incompetence is second to none. I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. I'll check in with our caller in Japan before we get to some of our other folks, see if he has any comments to share before we proceed. I heard a number of reports where they were talking about that. Who is culpable? That was even in the definition for black for the energy problem in Texas. And I saw where that even became a big talking point this week is green energy, as they call it, to blame. Did the wind turbines, did they freeze up and what have you? I ended up seeing a number of reports on that this week. Dr. Welsing, check the news. Newsweek, fact check, is green energy to blame for Texas power outages? A bout of extremely cold weather affecting vast swaths of the United States has left millions of people without power in Texas. According to poweroutages.us, more than 3 million customers had no power as of Wednesday morning, as the state experienced frigid temperatures that were well below freezing in some areas. The claim, some conservative commentators and lawmakers have focused their blame for the outages in Texas on the failures of green energy sources such as wind turbines. And it lists a number of folks who gave similar claims, right? Froze over, didn't work, blah, blah, blah. The facts. While some wind turbines have been forced to shut down due to the extreme cold weather, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, which operates the state's power grid, said Tuesday that failures in natural gas, coal, and nuclear energy systems were the cause of significantly more outages. Dan Woodfin, a senior ERCOT director, said on Tuesday, according to Bloomberg, we've had some issues with pretty much every kind of generating capacity in the course of this multi-day event. I'll post the report if folks, but I'd seen many of others. I'd heard many others where they basically said the same thing. Widespread failure. Green energy, not the only thing that failed. Seems like lots went wrong. Deep in the heart of Texas. Our caller in Japan, did you have commentary, sir?
You just reminded me that Prince Markie D of the Fat Boys just passed this week, and that I'm very sorry to hear that. I'm actually originally from the same neighborhood, East New York. They grew up just a few blocks down. I had older cousins that went to junior high school with them. Funny thing is, I just watched a video about their career when they first started. They won a rap contest when they were very, very young. They're 13, 14 years old and 15 years old. They weren't so big. They were a little chubby, but they weren't so big. In fact, in the early days, their name wasn't the Fat Boys. It was the Disco 3. Being fat just happened to be what it became a gimmick. Interviews where they did, and the record company promoted this. And the song, like as you just played the song, All You Can Eat, they got big after they got famous. I don't know how you would classify that. You might probably have better words than me. I don't know if that's medical terrorism or what, but just they were caused to be so big and fat. And you know, Buffy, who died so many years ago, who was the heaviest one, and he was the human beatbox, and he became kind of obsolete in the group once they became big mainstream because they had all that radio equipment. And I just find it kind of coincidentally, I don't know, odd, or that he who kind of, I don't know, would get kind of marginalized within the group, and he became the fattest one, and he died first, and now the other one is just, it's really sad. One thing that stood out in the news reports that you played, I saw the video of the 91-year-old Asian man who was knocked down, and I think he bumped into he fell on something there on the street, like kind of like a bike rack or something, and it just looked really, it's kind of horrifying to look at. But then, I've also seen videos of just black people mistreating each other that were just as, horrific, extreme, things you couldn't believe, and no real big outcry for them. Not to be heartless against the Asians, obviously, you know, that's part of my, my family and so on here. But it's just, I could really appreciate the quote from Dr. Welsing, the addition to the 10 stops that, you know, we should all, non-white people, all should stop squabbling and fighting amongst each other and against each other. I think it just plays into the hands of white supremacy. And just those particular comments, that's what really, some things that stood out to me from the news that I heard today. I think everything else, I'm out of the country, so some of those situations, I don't know them as in-depth as other callers, but that's what stood out for me today.
For sure. The grandsister, Dr. Welsing. Much obliged, our caller in Japan. Other folks who we missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I was looking at some local reports earlier today, and that term blackout was used also for a local protest, and they associated it with Black Lives Matter. Dream Defenders, and I think it was a few other organizations, and that's so important about words and how the term black has been associated with, I guess, for the most part, negativity or something dangerous and violent. And there are still words light at the end of the tunnel, a lot of phrases and metaphors that incorporate darkness being connected to something evil or something that's annoying or agitating. And to go to the segment about the, I guess, the anti-Asian attacks, definitely I think that people of different non-white groups are being mistreated. But I just don't think that black mistreatment, anti-blackness, isn't being focused on enough. And I think once that happens and we have enough understanding of racism, white supremacy, I think just in theory, just in my opinion, we'll be able to focus more on just, as you say, just racism being practiced. Racism is being practiced. But I have also been seeing those reports on where it says Asians being mistreated. And as far as the LAPD incident, I thought about, I think that's where Christopher Dorner was from, if I remember that story from some years ago. And I know he was talking about the issue of racism being practiced toward black people in the surrounding areas, residential areas. And he pretty much carried out an act of violence, murdering some people, and he ended up being killed himself. And that was a tragic situation. There are some other local reports that were made, because they've been doing a Black History Month report on black businesses. And they have this, like a vegan pizza business a little up the road in Alachua, Florida, where they have like spinach and tomatoes and like a lot of the vegan ingredients on different pizzas. So I thought that was interesting. And they showed one earlier today where they have like a fitness area owned by two black people, black male and black female. Other than that, that's pretty much it. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Yeah, where they focus attention is important in the system of white supremacy racism that happens on a regular basis. They generally are not going to focus attention in a very substantive way on, wow, black people being, I guess they might say the Black Lives Matter protests and what have you, but I feel like they generally do a pretty good job of diffusing, diluting even those protests. That's what I've seen the last six. They were effective. We wouldn't have to keep having these problems, these protests and such. Let's see. Did we miss anybody totally? Anybody that we missed totally? Grant, we'll assume that we grabbed all the folks who dialed in. Again, we will be here tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, and 12 noon Pacific, the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. We will chat it up, our folks in different parts of the world, kind of hear what has been taking place with the vaccines and all of that. I guess if we had to get one last comment in from our caller in Japan, since it's not super, it's Sunday afternoon for him. What is the situation there currently with COVID-19? Is it a problem, lockdowns, the vaccine? Have you been vaccinated? Just so we can include that in our assessment of all this.
Thank you. The vaccine, I don't have too much knowledge about what the vaccine program is. But as far as the COVID-19, it's nowhere near like what's going on and what I hear about what's going on in America, which is almost like it's, and this is our second lockdown. We had a kind of a more serious one at the late last summer where kids were home from school and everything. And, that was a lot more serious. This one just started, I believe, late December. And it was supposed to be 1 month. And then I think they extended it for another month. I think it's ending the first week of March. But it's not even really so much of a lockdown. It's mostly just that after 8 o'clock at night, no restaurants are open and a lot of things are closing. Gyms are closing. You know, any place where people would congregate pretty much closes after 8 o'clock. That's really almost the extent. What's one thing that's big in Japan, like business meetings, there's a lot of everything's moving to online. Business meetings, where in Japan, you know, they kind of do their business meetings over meals. That's been curtailed. Also, you know, to be honest, they do a lot of their business meetings in karaoke joints or, you know, in the company of night workers, so to speak. That's been curtailed. And also the prostitution business, which is technically illegal, but sort of, I don't know, semi-legal. That's also, they're trying to control that. Because you can't track that. The clusters and things like that, they move. It's kind of so fluid. That, schools are open still, but everything's pretty much what's really big here. I think, I'm not an expert medically at all, but I think like everyone just is masked up all the time. That's one really big thing. The hand washing, in a sense, There's a little bottle of a little spritzer bottle of alcohol in the doorway of every single shop you go to, anywhere you go, not just shops, but any building, anything that people enter into. So people are going to spray their hands and get a little spritz of alcohol, rub your palms together, enter. Let's say it's a supermarket. You go do your shopping. You come out. You spritz your hand again. And then, you know, you keep it moving. That's all day, every day, everywhere you go. Everyone is masked up. And I don't know. Japanese people, they don't get so close to each other anyway, I think. When it's crowded, yeah, but... You know, there's not a lot. It's not a hugging culture, like hugging and kissing and being all close and touching people up. You know, you bow from a slight distance a lot. So maybe that's what I think the masking and the hand washing, the hand sanitizing all day. And most people aren't. Most people, I think, are following the basic social distancing thing. We had like a New Year's celebration here. Most of the family didn't come, and people are just traveling less. But other than that, the lockdown is not like a serious lockdown like China or anything. So the situation is not so bad. Obviously, old people are hit a lot harder. That's where most of the deaths are. But other than that, it's not really so like epidemic proportions like what we read about in the States. Yeah, that's about it.
Fascinating. Much obliged for the update. Well, add that for tomorrow when we check in with our folks in different parts of the world to kind of get an update, and hopefully that can help folks kind of make some sense of what we've experienced for the past year. We will rest there until tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Much obliged for all the folks joining us this Saturday evening. Sunday afternoon. I hope it has been worthy of your time and energy. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We spent a lot of time talking about, you know, trying to eat correctly, taking care of oneself. That involves a lot, including sobriety. Drink more water. Super important anyway. In addition to being sober, let's hunker down. If you got to go out, especially if you're in the U.S. where there are lots of armed whites, if you have to go out, be very alert to what's happening around you. If it looks like people are being hostile, anybody, white person, non-white person, they're being rowdy, loud, exit. We are super risk averse in 2021. No need to be in verbal altercations, to be close, as we just heard, to be all in close proximity to someone. You don't know if this person is armed. You don't know if they have a group of folks with them who are also armed. If you did not leave your residence prepared to kill and die, exit. Get out of there. You can call enforcement officials as you leave. All of that said, if you're going out, you are sober. Driver or passenger, you are buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, we want to do the small things that we can to minimize contact with the Mark GED Furmans of the known universe. And we also need to be alert. Can't be paying attention to what's happening around us if you're texting and driving. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling, super simple, in the 10 stops, not calling other black people, any non-white people by any name other than what they wish to be called. Minimize conflict with other non-white people, for sure. Cal signing out. We will be here in about 12 hours. Replace white supremacy with justice. Thank you for tuning in. Sayonara.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.